the quietest moments, I wish I knew what I had to do. And even though the sun is shining, well, I feel the rain. Here it comes again, dear. And even when you showed me my heart was out of tune, but there's a shadow of doubt that's not letting me find you too soon. The music that you gave me, the language of my soul. Lord, I want to be with you. Won't you let me come in from the cold? Even though the stars are glistening and the ocean's deep, I just go to sleep. And then I create the silent movie. You become the star. Is that what you are, dear? Your whisper tells a secret. Your laughter brings me joy, and a wondrous feeling and nature's own little boy. But still the tears keep falling, they're raining from the sky. Well, let the ladder take us to go under before I get high.
Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, October 4th, 2021. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern to midnight. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org, click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If you would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Okay, we're going to pick up on our scripture reading where we left off last week. We're in the Gospel of Luke. And let's see, we're in chapter 4, I think. Yep, chapter 4, read by Alexander Scobie.
Chapter 4. And Jesus, being full of the Holy Ghost, returned from Jordan and was led by the Spirit into the wilderness, being 40 days tempted of the devil. And in those days he did eat nothing, and when they were ended, he afterward hungered. And the devil said unto him, If thou be the Son of God, command this stone that it be made bread. And Jesus answered him, saying, It is written that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word of God. And the devil, taking him up into an high mountain, showed unto him all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And the devil said unto him, All this power will I give thee, and the glory of them, for that is delivered unto me. And to whomsoever I will, I give it. If thou therefore wilt worship me, all shall be thine. And Jesus answered and said unto him, Get thee behind me, Satan, for it is written, Thou shalt worship the Lord thy God, and him only shalt thou serve. And he brought him to Jerusalem, and set him on a pinnacle of the temple, and said unto him, If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down from hence, for it is written, He shall give his angels charge over thee to keep thee, and in their hands they shall bear thee up, lest at any time thou dash thy foot against a stone. And Jesus answering said unto him, It is said, Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. And when the devil had ended all the temptation, he departed from him for a season. And Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee. And there went out a fame of him through all the region round about, and he taught in their synagogues, being glorified of all. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day, and stood up for to read. And there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Esaias. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord. And he closed the book, and he gave it again to the minister, and sat down. And the eyes of all them that were in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began to say unto them, This day is this scripture fulfilled in your ears. And all bare him witness, and wondered at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, Is not this Joseph's son? And he said unto them, Ye will surely say unto me this proverb, Physician, heal thyself. Whatsoever we have heard done in Capernaum, do also here in thy country. And he said, Verily I say unto you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. But I tell you of a truth, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elias, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when great famine was throughout all the land. But unto none of them was Elias sent, save unto Sarepta, a city of Sidon, unto a woman that was a widow. And many lepers were in Israel in the time of Eliseus the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, saving Naaman the Syrian. And all they in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath, and rose up and thrust him out of the city, and led him unto the brow of the hill whereon their city was built, that they might cast him down headlong. But he, passing through the midst of them, went his way, and came down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and taught them on the Sabbath days. and they were astonished at his doctrine, for his word was with power. And in the synagogue there was a man which had a spirit of an unclean devil, and cried out with a loud voice, saying, Let us alone! What have we to do with thee, thou Jesus of Nazareth? Art thou come to destroy us? I know thee who thou art, the Holy One of God. And Jesus rebuked him, saying, Hold thy peace, and come out of him. And when the devil had thrown him in the midst, he came out of him, and hurt him not. And they were all amazed, and spake among themselves, saying, What a word is this! For with authority and power he commandeth the unclean spirits, and they come out. And the fame of him went out into every place of the country round about. And he arose out of the synagogue, and entered into Simon's house. And Simon's wife's mother was taken with a great fever, and they besought him for her. And he stood over her, and rebuked the fever, and it left her. And immediately she arose and ministered unto them. Now when the sun was setting, all they that had any sick with divers diseases brought them unto him, and he laid his hands on every one of them, and healed them. And devils also came out of many, crying out and saying, Thou art Christ, the Son of God. And he, rebuking them, suffered them not to speak, for they knew that he was Christ. And when it was day, he departed and went into a desert place. And the people sought him and came unto him and stayed him, that he should not depart from them. And he said unto them, I must preach the kingdom of God to other cities also, for therefore am I sent. And he preached in the synagogues of Galilee.
John, if you're talking, we can't hear you yet.
Okay, thank you, Terry. I guess I forgot to unmute myself there. All right, just a reminder, we still have the campaign for constitutional sheriffs going, and getting a book to all the sheriffs in the United States. And we do have two states. We've had two individuals in the past. Last week we mentioned this, that an individual stepped up and bought 40 books and bought enough books to do their entire state. That was their intent. There's a couple of books left over, so because that particular state had just a couple under 40, and so we passed it on, of course, to some other sheriffs. Hopefully anybody that's got that ability, anybody that's got the funds to be able to do something like that, this is a good place to really donate and invest into the knowledge of the common law to our sheriffs. It's the sheriffs who will protect us if they were educated in the common law, educated in the Constitution, educated in the way that in what their job and their authority really is. And the fact of the matter is their purpose is to protect the sovereign. That's their sole purpose. And we the people are the sovereign. And they are here to protect us against an overreaching government on the federal level or even the local level and anywhere in between, of course. But unfortunately, they don't know it. They just don't know. A couple of them do. And more are starting to know and understand. I spoke with a sheriff about a week and a half ago. I think I mentioned this last week. One of the sheriffs have called me here in New York in one of the northern counties and thanked me for the book. And of course, I reminded him that it was the members that are purchasing these books and trying to get everything out. He had connected already with Sheriff Darr, and I presume and perceive, he didn't mention it, but I perceive that he's participating in the educational process that Sheriff Darr and Brent has put together. Every Thursday they get together for an hour and talk about the power and the authority of the sheriffs. This is the way we will save our republic. And of course, we the people need to be educated. We have to have government by consent. That means that we the people have to take control, seize control back, that which has been stolen from us quite some time ago. And return to a republic from a democracy that they have created and turned us into, and a democracy is the first step to an oligarchy, and we indeed are under an oligarchy. We've been under an oligarchy since at least President Kennedy. And there are certain presidents prior to Kennedy that, of course, obeyed the oligarchy, and President Kennedy, of course, was one that rejected and bucked their system and paid with his life. And we saw that Reagan tried to do something also, but here we are with Trump, and things are moving along, I think. I don't know how many of you are listening to the X-22 report. Dave has quite a bit of things, a lot of things to say about what's really going on today and where he thinks we are. And October of this year seems to be a focal point. I guess time will tell. All right, anyway, let's see. Tonight we're going to be looking at part 4 of the Jurist Handbook. And, you know, this is a very important handbook, and it's free of charge. Anybody can get it. Go up to National Liberty Alliance, highlight People's Duty, come down to Handbooks, click on Handbooks, and you'll find numerous handbooks there. And, of course, the one that we're going to be looking into, is the Jurist Handbook. And this has just been updated just a couple of days ago. You know, I've been reading through it and making some corrections or additions. Nothing major or anything. But I think it's finally perfected. And maybe one day we'll maybe find some more corrections or maybe find something else we should add to it, and we'll do that. But this handbook is free of charge, and hopefully one day we'll be able to get the funding necessary to, get together maybe 10, 20, or 50,000 handbooks that we can start to distribute to people. I know we did do that quite some time ago. We were selling them for 65 cents a piece. There's someone's up there that's taken our books, someone up on Amazon, has taken our booklets and has been selling them for $5 or $10. I've been meaning to try to do something about that. I don't mind people copying them and doing them, but they actually are making money off of it, and it's not a good thing. And again, if we can buy enough of them in one shot, we can sell them for 65 cents a piece, and that's pretty good. I mean, right now, I looked at Amazon. I was going to put some books up. Maybe I will do some books on Amazon, but I think the we'll have to sell them for somewhere between $3, $4, or $5 a piece, which I think is a lot of money for a little handbook. But you can download this for free and print it out right off of your printer off your computer. So all of these handbooks should be downloaded, and one of the most important handbooks for the people, in my opinion, strong opinion, is the Committee of Safety Handbook, and that's. That last date update was on April 26, 2021. I might go through here one day soon and just read through it to see if there's any more corrections that need to be made and if there's anything else that should be added into it. Of course, what we're looking at tonight is going to be the part 4, which is the final part of the Jurist Handbook. And that's an extremely powerful book. I'm sure everybody that's been listening probably agree with that. We've got a lot of powerful quotes and information in here. And from the very beginning all the way through the end, extremely, extremely powerful. Matter of fact, some of the things within that. Francine, we're getting, you need to mute yourself. So we're getting, goodness, I lost my train of thought here. Anyway, there's a lot of powerful things in the handbook. The Committee of Safety Handbook is an extremely important book because it is a plan, okay, a roadmap to government by consent. It's how to create a Committee of Safety and what is the process. You know, some people are talking about trying to make contact with the sheriff, and some people have bought books to give to the sheriff personally. And, I'm requesting that people not do that, that they do it through us and that we would send it out because we send it out with a couple of letters And most people know that, but we may have some new people with us. But so we send a letter out that Sheriff Darr introducing the book and National Liberty Alliance. And, of course, National Liberty Alliance offers an education to the deputies and information, more information for the sheriff, and a lot of resources by coming to our website. And also invites them to connect with Sheriff Darr and Brent in order to join the course that they've got going right now on the powers and the authorities of the sheriff. We should be sending them out, and there's a process to approach the sheriff. Okay, unless you've already approached the sheriff and you know the sheriff and you're having some maybe relationship of one way or another with the sheriff. And I know here in Dutchess County, through our group, we've made contact with our sheriff a long time ago. And so we do have contact and somewhat of a relationship with him. But this handbook and Committee of Safety, to create a Committee of Safety, will create a stronger bond and make the invitation for them to join the Committee of Safety, which is an important part of our Committee of Safety, is that the sheriff join up with us. So there is a process, and it's laid out in this Committee of Safety handbook, how to organize your county. And at some point, it lays out what you need to accomplish before approaching the sheriff. If you have not approached the sheriff yet, you need to accomplish certain things and set the stage of your Committee of Safety before you approach the sheriff, and then give him a copy of the resolutions. And matter of fact, we have a copy of that up here also. Let me see if I can find that. Excuse me. Let's see, we have the charter, okay, an important part of that process, and Committee of Safety resolutions. And those two documents are extremely powerful, and it should be sealed. Each Committee of Safety should get their own county seal as a Committee of Safety. We even talk about that in our handbook on how to do that and where you might buy it. I mean, there's many places you can get it, but I think we lay it out on how you can get it quite simply through Staples. Once the sheriff takes a look at that, and especially if he's been primed a little, if he's gotten the book and he's starting to read the book, so he's becoming primed to common law and what his true powers and authorities are, and his purpose is to protect the sovereign, and then we approach him, and the charter lays out very, very clearly, and our resolutions very, very clearly on what our purpose is, what our intentions are, and how we can have government by consent by pursuing those processes. I can assure you there is no other way. Government by consent is not possible unless the people within every county, or at least most of the counties across the United States, to start the process of Committees of Safety. Committees of Safety is how our founding fathers created this nation and maintained it in the first and the beginning. And we've been robbed of it. Robbed of it, totally robbed. I do want to go back. Now that I'm thinking about this, there's some changes I want to make in that handbook, because I don't think we should pursue becoming committeemen. First of all, it takes a lot of time to get to the process to become an elected committeeman. It becomes a battle and so on and so forth. And I thought about it, and over the past few months I've come to realize, wait a second, they have taken control of this whole process and set up statutes and codes in a process, an election law in every single state on how to accomplish these things, and then there's a certain amount of control by that. And of course, that whole thing has been hijacked. We don't need to be elected. We, the people, can step up and take the authority and do what we have to do. So I'm going to revamp that part at some point in the very near future, I hope. And I'll alert everyone when we do, and maybe I'll read that next whenever I get that done. Okay, but tonight we're going to be looking into the Part 4 of the Jurist Handbook. Let me go back to things here. I believe we're going to pick it up. I think I opened it. There it is, on the Jurist Oath. If I close this one down. Okay, I believe we're picking up here on page 27, the Jurist Oath. But let's we'll get going on that. And then after that, what we'll do is we'll open up for questions just on that subject. And once we exhaust that, then we'll move on with the rest of our program. But we are going to go open up for anybody who's got a question or a comment or a correction concerning this handbook, at least in the beginning. So, okay, we'll get started on that. All right, this is part four of the Jurist Handbook. We're picking up on page 28. About the middle of the page, the juror's oath. A juror's oath given by the magistrate usually states something to the effect of, "Do you and each of you solemnly swear that you will well and truly try and true deliverance made between the people and whatever the person, the defendant, and a true verdict render according to the evidence, so help you God." If the magistrate judge instructs the jurist beyond the oath, the jurist has a duty to ignore the magistrate judge, follow their conscience as they see fit, and not the opinion of a magistrate. If a magistrate instructs the jurist claiming that you must not substitute or follow your own notion or opinion as to what the law is or ought to be, and that it is your duty to apply the law as I explain it to you, regardless of the consequences, that would be jury tampering, and you should report it to the jury administrators immediately. The jurist vow. The jurist vow taken by the jury administrators. I vow to the governor of the universe, in my capacity as a jurist, to ensure that all public servants uphold the Declaration of Independence, the U.S. Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, and to carry out all of my deliberation under natural law principled under justice, honor, and mercy, and to strictly adhere to the following two legal maxims. Number one, every right, when withheld, must have a remedy, and every injury its proper redress. And number two, in the absence of a victim, there can be no crime. Corpus delicti, the state cannot be the victim. Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to the to that which proceedeth out of his mouth. Tampering and proper instructions to the jury. To consider the judge as the ultimate arbiter of all constitutional questions is a very dangerous doctrine indeed, one which would place us under the despotism of an oligarchy. Thomas Jefferson. Theophilus Parsons. If a jury accepts as the law that which the judge states, then that juror has accepted the exercise of absolute authority of a government employee and has surrendered a power and a right that once was the citizen's safeguard of liberty. For the saddest epitaph which can be carved in memory of a vanished liberty is that it was lost because its possessors failed to stretch forth a saving hand while yet there was time. J.C. O'Connell versus R. Every jury in the land is tampered with and falsely instructed by the judge when it is told it must take or accept as the law that which has been given to them, or that they must bring in a certain verdict, or that they can decide only the facts of the case. Taylor versus Louisiana. The purpose of a jury is to guard against the exercise of arbitrary power, to make available the common sense judgment of the community as a hedge against the overzealous or mistaken prosecutor, and in preference to the professional or perhaps overconditioned or biased response of a judge. U.S. versus Datcher. A defendant's right to inform the jury of that information essential to prevent oppression by the government is clearly of constitutional magnitude. Instruction to jurors in criminal cases in Maryland. Members of the jury, this is a criminal case, and under the Constitution and the laws of the state of Maryland in a criminal case, the jury are the judges of the law as well as the facts in the case. so that whatever I tell you about the law, while it is intended to be helpful to you in reaching a just and proper verdict in the case, it is not binding upon you as members of the jury, and you may accept or reject it, and you may apply the law as you apprehend it to be in the case. United States versus Maline. If the jury feels the law is unjust, we recognize the undisputed power of the jury to acquit, even if its verdict is contrary to the law as given by a judge and contrary to the evidence. If the jury feels that the law under which the defendant is accused is unjust, or that exigent circumstances justified the action of the accused, or for any reason which appeals to their logic or passion, the jury has the power to acquit, and the courts must abide by that decision. Alan Shefflin and John Van Dyke. The arguments for opposing the nullification instructions are, in our view, deficient because they fail to weigh the political advantages gained by not lying to the jury. What impact will this deception have on jurors who felt coerced into their verdict by the judge's instructions and who learn after trial that they could have voted their conscience and acquitted? Such a juror is less apt to respect the legal system. Justice Kent. The true criterion of a legal power is its capacity to produce a definite effect, liable neither to censure nor review. And a verdict of not guilty in a criminal case is in every respect absolutely final. The jury are not liable to punishment, nor the verdict to control. No attaint lies, nor can a new trial be awarded. The exercise of this power in the jury has been sanctioned and upheld in constant activities from the earliest ages. H.G. Wells, the jury is the Achilles heel of tyrants. Jury Nullification by Dr. Julian Heikkilen. Jury nullification was introduced into America in 1735 in the trial of John Peter Zenger, printer of the New York Weekly Journal. Zenger repeatedly attacked Governor William Cosby of New York in his journal. This was a violation of the seditious libel law, which forbidden criticism of the king or his appointed officers. The attacks became sufficient to bring Zenger to trial. He clearly was guilty of breaking the law, which held that true statements could be libelous. However, Zenger's lawyer, Andrew Hamilton, addressed himself to the jury, arguing that the court's law was outmoded. Hamilton contended that falsehood was the principal thing that makes a libel. It took the jury only a few minutes to nullify the law and declare Zenger not guilty. Ever since, the truth has been a defense in libel cases. Several state constitutions, including Georgia's Constitution of 1777 and the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1790, specifically provided that the jury shall be the judge of law as well as facts. In Pennsylvania Supreme Court Justice James Wilson noted in his Philadelphia Law Lectures in 1790 that when a difference in sentiment takes place between the judge and the jury with regard to a point of law, the jury must do their duty and their whole duty. They must decide the law as well as the facts. In 1879, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court noted that the power of the jury to be judge of the law in criminal cases is one of the most valuable securities guaranteed by the Bill of Rights. John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, stated in 1789, "The jury has the right to judge both the law as well as the facts in controversy." Samuel Chase, U.S. Supreme Court Justice and signer of the Declaration of Independence, said in 1796, "The jury has the right to determine both the law and the facts." U.S. Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes said in 1902, "The jury has the power to bring a verdict in the teeth of both the law and facts." Harlan F. Stone, the 12th Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, stated in 1941, "The law itself is on trial quite as much as the cause which is to be decided." In a 1972 decision, U.S. v. Dougherty, the court said, "The pages of history shine on instances of the jury's exercise of its prerogative to disregard instructions of the judge." Likewise, the U.S. Supreme Court in Duncan v. Louisiana implicitly endorsed the policies behind nullification when it stated, "If the defendant preferred the common-sense judgment of the jury to the more tutored but less sympathetic reaction of a single judge, he was to have it." In recent times, courts have tried to erode the nullification powers of juries. Particular impetus for this was given by the fact that all white jurors in the southern states refused to convict whites of crimes against blacks. As a result, there is a practice of magistrate judges to incorrectly instruct the jury that the magistrate judge determines the law and that the jury is limited to determining the facts. Such an instruction defeats the purpose of the jury, which is to protect the defendant from the tyranny of the state and the tyranny of the law. The problem with an all-white jury that refuses to convict whites that committed crimes against blacks is not in jury nullification, but in jury selection. The jury was not representative of the community and would not provide a fair and impartial trial. In recent years, jury nullification has played a role in the trials of Mayor Marion Barry of Washington, D.C., for drug use, Oliver North for his role in the Iran-Contra affair, and Bernard Goetz for his assault in New York City subway. In Les Miserables, Victor Hugo highlighted the difference between justice and law. The jury's responsibility is to deliver justice, not to uphold the law. Judges in Maryland and Indiana are required by law to inform the jury of its rights of nullifications. Article 23 of the Maryland Bill of Rights states, "In a trial of all criminal cases, the jury shall be the judge of the law as well as the facts, except that the court may pass upon the sufficiency for the evidence to sustain a conviction." Nullification applies just as much in other states, including Pennsylvania. Article 1 of the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania states in Section 6, "Trial by jury shall be as heretofore, and the right thereof remain inviolate." Section 25 states, "To guard against transgressions of the high powers which we have delegated, we declare that everything in this article is accepted out of the general powers of government and shall forever remain inviolate." Taken together, these two sections means that jurors shall have the power that they had henceforth, i.e., when the Constitution was adopted to the present. Judges usually do not inform the jury of this right. Even worse, some judges instruct jury that it does not have the right to interpret or nullify the law, but only to determine the facts near the end of alcohol prohibitions. Jurors refuse to convict for alcohol violations. Has the time arrived for jurors to do the same for marijuana violations? It is useful to distinguish between the juror's right to decide questions of law and its power to do so. The jury's power to decide the law in returning a general verdict is indisputable. The debate of the 19th century revolved around the question of whether the jury had a legal and moral right to decide questions of law. Underlying the conception of the jury as a bulwark against the unjust use of governmental power was the distrust of legal experts and a faith in the ability of the common people. Upon this faith rested the prevailing political philosophy of the Constitution framing era, that popular control over and participation in government should be maximized. Thus, John Adams stated that the common people should have as complete a control as decisive, a negative, in every judgment of a court of judicature, as they have through the legislature in other decisions of government. Since natural law was thought to be accessible to the ordinary man, the theory invited each juror to inquire for himself whether a particular rule of law was consonant with principles of higher law. This view is reflected in John Adams' statement that it would be an absurdity for jurors to be required to accept the judge's view of the law against their own opinion, judgment, and conscience. During the first third of the 19th century, magistrate judges frequently charged jurors that they were the judges of the law as well as the facts and were both bound by the magistrate judge's instructions. A charge that the jury had the right to consider the law had a corollary at the level of trial procedure. Counsel had the right to argue the law, its interpretation, and its validity to the jury. The pages of history shine on instances of the jury's exercise of its prerogative to disregard instructions of the judge. It is presumed that the jurors are the best judges of fact. It is, on the other hand, presumed that the courts are the best judges of law. But still both objects are within your power of decision. You have the right to take upon yourselves to judge of both and to determine the law and as well as the facts in controversy. Thomas Jefferson, I consider trial by jury as the only anchor even yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution. John Adams, it's not only the juror's right but his duty in that case to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court. Alexander Hamilton, jurors should acquit even against the judge's instructions if exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty they have a clear conviction that the charges of the court is wrong. Judge Thurgood Marshall, illegal and unconstitutional jury selection procedures cast doubt on the integrity of the whole judicial process. They create the appearance of bias in the decision of the individual cases, and they increase the risk of actual bias as well. Chief Justice Matthews, it was impossible any manner of law could come in question till a matter of facts was settled and stated and agreed by the jury, and of such matter of facts they, the jury, were the only competent judges. Sir John Vancom, without a fact agree, it is impossible for a judge or any other to know the law relating to the fact nor to direct a verdict concerning it. Hence it follows that the judge can never direct what the law is in any matter controverted. Lysander Spooner, the bounds set to the power of government by the trial by jury as well hereafter be shown are these, that the government shall never touch the property of person or natural or civil rights of an individual against his consent, except for the purpose of bringing them before a jury for trial, unless in pursuance and execution of a judgment or decree rendered by a jury in each individual case, upon such evidence and such law as are satisfactory to their own understanding and conscience, irrespective of all legislation of the government. John Adams, it is not only his right, but his duty to find the verdict according to his own best understanding, judgment, and conscience, though in direct opposition to the direction of the court. William Cussler, unless the jury can exercise its community conscience role, our judicial system will have become so inflexible that the effect may well be a progressive rationalization of protest into channels that will threaten the very continuance of the system itself. To put it another way, the jury is the safety valve that must exist in this society, is to be able to accommodate its own internal stresses and strains. If the community is to sit in the jury box, its decisions cannot be legally limited to a conscienceless application of fact to law. Lysander Spooner, For more than 600 years, that is, since Magna Carta in 1215, there has been no clearer principle of English or American constitutional law than that in criminal cases, it is not only the right and the duty of the juries to judge what are the facts, or what is the law, and what was the moral intent of the accused, but that it is also their right and their primary and paramount duty to judge of the justices of the law, and to hold all laws invalid that are, in their opinion, unjust or oppressive, and all persons guiltless in violating or resisting the execution of such laws. Alexander Hamilton, that in criminal cases, nevertheless, the courts are constitutional advisors of the jury in matter of law, who may compromise their conscience by lightly or rationally disregarding that advice, but may still more compromise their conscience by following it, if exercising their judgment with discretion and honesty, they have a clear conviction that the charge of the court is wrong. Alan Shefflin and John Van Dyke. When a jury acquits a defendant, even though he or she clearly appears to be guilty, the acquittal conveys significant information about community attitudes and provides a guideline for future prosecutorial discretion in the enforcement of the laws. Because of the high acquittal rate in prohibition cases during the 1920s and the early 1930s, prohibition laws could not be enforced. The repeal of these laws is traceable to the refusal of juries to convict those accused of alcohol traffic. Clarence Darrow. Why not reenact the code of Blackstone's day? Why the judges were all for it, every one of them. And the only way we got rid of those laws was because jurors were too humane to obey the courts. That is the only way we get rid of punishing old women or of hanging old women in New England, because in spite of all the courts, the juries will no longer convict them for a crime that never existed. Oregon Constitution. The jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. Indiana Constitution. In the criminal cases whatsoever, the jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. New York Constitution. The jury shall have the right to determine the law and the facts. Constitution of Maryland. In the trial of all criminal cases, the jury shall have the judges of law as well as the facts. Hasten versus the U.S. Within 6 years after the Constitution was established, the right of the jury upon the general issue to determine the law as well as the facts in contrary was unhesitatingly and unqualifiedly affirmed by this court in the first of the very few trials of the jury ever had at its bar under the original jurisdiction conferred upon it by the Constitution. Morissetti versus the United States. But juries are not bound by what seems inescapable logic to judges. U.S. versus Thatcher. Judicial and prosecutorial misconduct still occur, and Congress is not yet an infallible body incapable of making tyrannical laws. U.S. versus Wilson. In criminal cases, a jury is entitled to acquit the defendant because it has no sympathy for the government's position. There exists no crime absent criminal intent. In the essay of trial by jury, Lysander Spooner, in Chapter 9, The Criminal Intent, wrote, "It is a maxim of common law that there can be no crime without a criminal intent, and it is a perfectly clear principle, although one which judges have in a great measure overthrown in practice, that jurors are to judge of the moral intent of an accused person and hold him guiltless, whatever his act, unless they find him to have acted with a criminal intent, that is, with a design to do what he knew to be criminal." This principle is clear because the question for the jury is to determine whether the accused be guilty or not guilty. Guilt is a personal quality of the actor, not necessarily involved in the act, but in depending also upon the intent or motive with which the act was done. Consequently, the jury must find that he acted from a criminal motive before they can declare him guilty. There is no moral justice in, nor any political necessity for, punishing a man for any act whatever that he may have committed if he have done it without any criminal intent. There can be no moral justice in punishing for such an act, because there having been no criminal motive, there can have been no more motive which justice can take cognizant of as demanding or justifying punishment. There can be no political necessity for punishing to warn against similar acts in future, because if one man have injured another, however unintentionally, he is liable, and justly liable, to a civil suit for damages, and in this suit he will be compelled to make compensation for the injury, notwithstanding his innocence of any intention to injure. He must bear the consequence of his own act, instead of throwing them upon another, however innocent he may have been of any intention to do wrong. And the damages he will have to pay will be a sufficient warning to him not to do the act again. A case in point. Recently a prosecutor convicting an uninformed grand jury to indict a woman who had forgotten that she had left a young child in her vehicle, and the child died. Clearly there was no criminal intent, and one would think that the loss of her child is more than enough penance for her indiscretion. This necessity for criminal intent to justify conviction is proved by the issue which the juries are to try, and the verdict they are to pronounce. The issue they are to try is guilty or not guilty, and those are the terms they are required to use in rendering their verdicts. But it is plain falsehood to say that a man is guilty unless he has done an act which he knew to be criminal. This necessity for a criminal intent, in other words for guilt, as a preliminary to conviction, makes it impossible that a man can be rightfully convicted for an act that is intrinsically innocent, though forbidden by the government. Because guilt is an intrinsic quality of actions and motives, and not one that can be imparted to them by arbitrary legislation. All the effects of the government, therefore, to make offenses by statute out of acts that are not criminal by nature must necessarily be ineffectual unless a jury will declare a man guilty for an act that is really innocent. The corruption of judges in their attempts to uphold the arbitrary authority of the government by procuring the conviction of an individual for acts innocent in themselves and forbidden only by some tyrannical statute, the commission of which therefore indicates no criminal intent, is very apparent. To accomplish this object, they have in modern times held it to be unnecessarily that indictments should charge, as by the common law they were required to do, that an act was done wickedly, feloniously, with malice aforethought, or in any manner that implied a criminal intent, without which there can be no criminality, but that it is sufficient to charge simply that it was done contrary to the form of the statutes in such case made and provided. This form of indictment proceeds plainly upon the assumption that the government is absolute and that it has authority to forbid any act it pleases, however innocent in its nature the act may be. Judges have been driven to the alternative of either sanctioning this new form of indictment, which they never had any constitutional right to sanction, or of seeing the authority of many of the statutes of the government fall to the ground, because the acts forbidden by the statutes were so plainly innocent in their nature that even the government itself had not the face to allege that the commission of them applied or indicated any criminal intent. To get rid of the necessity of showing criminal intent and thereby further to enslave the people by reducing them to the necessity of a blind, unreasoning submission to the arbitrary will of the government and of a surrender of all rights in their own part to judge what are their constitutional and natural rights and liberties. Courts have invented another idea, which they have incorporated among the pretended maxims upon which they act in criminal trials, viz., that ignorance of the law excuses no one, as if it were in a nature of things possible that there could be an excuse more absolute and complete. What else than ignorance of the law is it that excuses persons under the years of discretion and men of imbecile minds? What else than ignorance of the law is it that excuses judges themselves for their own erroneous decisions? Nothing. They are every day committing errors, which would be crimes, but for their ignorance of the law, and yet these same judges who claim to be learned in the law, and who yet could not hold their offices for a day, but for the allowance which the law makes for their ignorance, are continually asserting it to be a maxim, that ignorance of the law excuses no one, by which, of course, they really mean that it excuses no one but themselves, and especially that it excuses no unlearned man who comes before them charged with crimes. This preposterous doctrine that ignorance of the law excuses no one is asserted by the courts because it is an indispensable one to the maintenance of absolute power in the government. It is indispensable for this purpose because, if it be once admitted that the people have any rights and liberties which the government cannot lawfully take from them, then the question arises in regard to every statute of the government, whether it be the law or not, that is, whether it infringes or not the rights or the liberties of the people. Of this question, every man must, of course, judge according to the light of his own mind. And no man can be convicted unless the jury find not only that the statute is law, that it does not infringe the rights or the liberties of the people, but also that it was clearly the law, so clearly consistent with the rights and liberties of the people, as that the individual himself who transgressed it knew it to be so, and therefore had no moral excuse for transgressing it. Government see that if ignorance of the law were allowed to excuse a man for any act whatsoever, it must excuse him for transgression all statutes whatsoever, which he himself thinks inconsistent with his rights and liberties. But such a doctrine would, of course, be inconsistent with the maintenance of arbitrary power by the government, and hence governments will not allow the plea, although they will not confess their true reasons for disallowing it. Conclusion. To decide cases correctly, grand and petty jurors must be honest and open-minded. They must have both integrity and good judgment. The continued vitality of the jury system depends on these attributes. To meet their responsibilities, jurors must decide the facts and apply the law impartially. They must not favor the rich or the poor. They must treat alike all individuals. Justice should be rendered to all persons without regard to race, color, religion, sex, or the legislated law. The performance of jury duty is the fulfillment of a high civic obligation. Conscientious service brings its own reward in the satisfaction of an important task well done. There is no more valuable work that the average citizen can form in support of justice than the full and honest discharge of this jury duty. The effectiveness of our natural law system itself is largely measured by integrity and justness of the jurors who serve the people's court. The Bill of Rights are not to be defeated by any legislative or judicial rulings. Amendment 1. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or forbidding the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Amendment 2. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Amendment 3. No soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in times of war, but in manner as to be prescribed by law. Amendment 4. The right of the people to be secured in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Amendment 5. No person shall be held to answer for capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment of an indictment of a grand jury, except in the case arising in the land of naval forces or in the militia, when in actual service in time of war or public danger. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. Amendment 6. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and the cause of the accusation to be confronted with the witness against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witness in his favor, and to have assistance of counsel for his defense. Number 7, Amendment 7. In suits of common law, where the value of controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise re-examined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law. Amendment 8. Excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Amendment 9. The enumeration of the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. And Amendment 10. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor forbidden by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. All right, that brings us to the end and the conclusion of the Jurist Handbook. Okay, you know, if this was understood by all people who sit on juries, whether it's grand juries or petit jury, we would have true just courts. Any court of law is to be decided by the people. Only equity, a court of equity, is to be decided by a single judge with the ability to appeal, so the appellate process is involved there, of course. When the people decide, when 12 people come together and they decide, that's the final judgment. There can be no appeal from the deciders of the law. And if there's anything that this booklet really, makes quite clear, to put everything into a nutshell, is the fact that the sovereign makes the law. If only all the people can understand that and understand what that means. Only the sovereign makes the law. We, the people, ordained and established the Constitution for them. And we laid out the process and the authorities that we've given them. And they don't have the authority to give to take the authority we gave to a particular group, like legislators, for instance. The legislators don't have the power and authority to pass that legislation off to anyone else, like they think they could have done with the Rules Enabling Act of 1934, which they themselves didn't have the power or the authority to write themselves. How much more giving it to the Supreme Court, which passed it off, of course, the whole process was set up a fix, to pass it off to the Bar Association. So bar attorneys were the minions of the New World Order, put together the rules of the court. And our courts just have gone far worse than ever. Today, of course, anybody who's paying attention, it is extremely rare for your unalienable rights to be upheld in any court of law in the United States. Very, very rare. and the federal courts are the worst. But maybe that's not true. The state courts are really seriously defunct. And in courts that aren't even courts, county courts, village courts, they don't have any power or authority at all. They have no right to exist. They are not courts of record. They're just destructive, just destruction. So unless the people understand this, unless we the people understand this, we cannot have government by consent. And that is why it is so important for everyone to get educated in this process and to understand what common law is and to understand the process and the procedures and the structure of our government that we have. It is extremely important that we make sure our sheriffs understand the powers and the authorities and what their true job is, which is to defend the sovereign, to protect the sovereign, to prevent an overreaching government. That's his job. And when he fails in that job, we need to get rid of them. We either just don't vote him back in if his time is coming up, or we recall them. But we have to put our sheriffs on notice, and we have to really first offer the education to them before we would put a sheriff on notice that is not applying what he should be applying in his job, which is, again, to protect the sovereign. So, all right, with that, it brings us to the end of this handbook. This is a four part. We did it in 5 weeks. I think week two we steered away from it because we had something else that came up that we wanted to address, and then we went back to it. This reading could be found up at National Liberty Alliance under the weekly call. If you click on that, you'll be able to go back and listen to all of the, all four parts. So part four will be posted up today. And of course, most importantly, we have access to this handbook, as we have mentioned, underneath People's Duty, come down handbooks, to find handbooks, you click on that and you will find this handbook. And you can download it and print it out and share it. This handbook is exactly what needs to be used for the orientation of a jury. Imagine how just our courts can be if every jurist was orientated in this. The handbooks that they have right now is destructive to common law. It puts all the power into the hands of the government and makes the judge ultimately the decider. When we the people open a court of record, and I've got a couple of courts of records personally going on, and we've got, of course, National Liberty Alliance has a few courts of records going on, and when a judge seizes controls and starts to make decisions and decide what he or she is going to allow into the court and what they're not going to allow into the court, and deciding who can come back in if they've defaulted. It's just a mockery of justice. It's a destruction. And this should open the eyes of anyone who hears these things and starts to understand and realize these things. We need to have government by consent if liberty is to prevail. We need to have government by consent if the republic is to survive. We need to have government by consent if America is to continue forward. Okay, with that, I see we've got a couple of people in the queue. And again, we're only focusing in on questions, comments, or corrections offered for this book the contents of the book. And then after that, we'll open up in a little while for questions on any subject matter. But right now, we'll take our first person in the queue, and that is Rosalind. You got the mic. You should be unmuted.
Hi there, John. Yes, this is Rosalind from Pennsylvania. I'm doing pretty good, thanks. One major question. I guess I want to start with this, even though I have another smaller question, or less significant question also. But this whole idea of government by consent, it just seems like the people don't even have this concept that they themselves are qualified to judge something, because we have been so indoctrinated, or so, I don't know what the word is, made so impotent in our belief that we are capable of judging the fact in the law or in any matter, but that the experts, we've got this idea that the experts are the only ones that can do it, and it just seems like we need such a revolution of the mind to be able to accept, grasp, and to embrace, you know, this belief in ourselves that we can indeed judge, and we ought to judge, the jury ought to judge the facts and the law. And I guess to me that just seems like it's going to require an act of God to wake up the people to that. But I do know that we have to keep speaking, and that there are people that do understand this, and that it's, you know, unfortunately, that's what distinguishes the sheep from the leaders, is the sheep are just followers of what they've been told. But so,
well, I agree. I'd like to respond to that before you go further on. I agree with you. It would be an act of God, and the act is referred to as a blessing. You know, we have one of the purposes of government is to secure, right in the beginning, the preamble of the Constitution. The purpose is to secure the blessings of liberty, which makes the point that liberty is a blessing, and only a just people, a morally minded people, as our founders have told us, can have a true republic. Only a morally minded people. So we have to have a bent knee to the Lord, to God. Now, it doesn't require the entire nation to have that. It requires the people who are participating. Majority of the people who are participating have to have that bent knee before the Lord, and to realize this and to bring this forward. And I think, you know, the opportunity is here. And I do believe that God is blessing this nation, as I watch to see what's been going on these past couple of years. And also the people responding in ways, and every place you go and the people are talking, you know, the patriots are talking, they're acknowledging God. They're coming with a bent knee. They're bringing God back into the dialogue. And this is so important, without which we cannot have liberty, without which we can't have what we have laid out in the Bill of Rights. That Bill of Rights is, again, the blessings from God. And but I do believe we have the opportunity. You know, as it was said, you know, and again, I think it was Jefferson, could have been Franklin, but, you know, I should go look up to find out who actually said this, but I think it was Jefferson. You know, we don't have government by the majority. We have government by the majority who participate. And right now, the participators are the people that are controlled by the elite. They're the two major parties. Mm-hmm. And even the other parties, they're controlled by the elite, too. They just don't realize it. Okay, they're all controlled by the elite. We got to separate that. I heard today, or yesterday, the last few days, I heard on the X-22, Dave was talking about the fact that the realization that how serious the information is coming out, how serious this problem is against the Democrats and what they're doing, but also Republicans. Now, we always knew there's been rhinos and problems, but we never realized how many of the Republicans are involved with the Democrats in this process of the destruction of our election system that they have totally destroyed and taken control and fixed for their own benefit. And so, but we have the opportunity through establishing committees of safety. You know, we have 10,000 members, and it's a shame that all 10,000 members aren't really active. But hopefully when things really break, maybe that'll shake them to wake up and take a second look and realize maybe they should be doing something. But I perceive that we need less than 1 million people. There are 300 million people in the United States, 300 and some odd million people, I believe. The last I heard, anyway, was 350 million. But there's about 300 million people in the United States. We don't even really need 1 million people. But we need to be the majority. We need to take over. If every single community, if every single county, okay, established a committee of safety and worked with their sheriffs, and if each one of these counties had maybe a couple hundred people, and that's all they need, because that's all the committee. In my county, oh goodness, did I forget? I think it's 200 and, goodness, I always knew this too. I think it was 259 committee men in the entire county where I live, in Dutchess County, New York. So we need about 200 people in every county to become active. And that's not an unreasonable thing, considering the problems of today, the people waking up and realizing a lot of people want to do something. Unfortunately, they're not hearing the message of what they can do. I hear over and over and over and over again, many places I listen to get my information, where people are told to get active, but they don't tell them what to do because they don't know what to tell them to do.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they say, keep on doing this and keep on doing that. And there's no consistency with it. There's no true organization with it. But it's not going to solve the problem. The only thing that's going to solve the problem, and I don't want to deter people from doing things, they should probably continue doing whatever they're doing, but they need to add to this the Committee of Safety so they can have the power and the control of their government, and we can bring back our just courts, we can bring back a just nation, and I do believe if that were to happen, we would bring back a just world. Now, it won't be perfect, of course, because we're all sinners, saved by grace, and there's evil in this world, and evil will continue, and most people will go, you know, as the Bible tells us, narrow is the path that leads to life and everlasting, everlasting life, but broad is the way, and broad is the path that leads to everlasting destruction, and so that has not changed, and it never will, but it's time for God's people, and those who are willing to work with God's people to establish this moral process, this moral system that our founders have put together and given to us. Mm-hmm. And this is the blessings from God, the blessings that we can have of liberty. So that's what it's going to take. And that is an act of God, just by blessing us. And I am convinced also that the Bible speaks about a return at the end to him, and that the whole world will cry out and enjoy once this evil is really put down or destroyed. The Bible talks about the world coming to, the government, shall I say, governments coming to judgment. And I see that coming. Governments are going to be judged. And that's a requirement. It's a prerequisite before the judgment day itself. So that has got to happen. But go ahead. You wanted to continue on with something else.
Well, it's just, yes. I wanted to, but again, it's a matter of the people realizing, like you're saying, these things. And the truth is, and we know, that there has been a very clear attempt and actions taken, strategies and actions taken to dumb down the people so that we wouldn't know. And of course we know that education is got to be the focus because this is what is going to lead the people to realize, to come to that point, to realize that they can, they're equipped. But again, I come back to these elites, and I have been focusing a bit on the bar because to me it seems like that's the cancer. You might say, I was thinking earlier, maybe it's kind of like the brain of this monster that's taken over.
The bar is the minions of the New World Order. They are the controllers. Yeah. They control everything. They control our pharmaceuticals, our medical system. They control everything you can think of. They have their hands. Anything of power or authority, they have a control, and it's set it forth and brought it into a statutory processes that just totally eliminates our liberty, our republic, our natural law.
And what it we know the White Hats are doing is they are, this plan of Q and the White Hats is to expose these people, because that's what will wake the people up. And so I'm kind of thinking along that line that, you know, I'm leading a committee of safety in Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, and, you know, I want to have a way, because there's a lot of people, actually there's more and more people, and it's wonderful, that are doing, you know, things, that are fighting back, that are standing up, that are getting to know the truth. Even Gary made up an amazing diagram that I hope to use to help bring these people together. But somehow I have to be able to expose what has impeded, you know, this progress of the, or this, not progress, but this restoration of the people to their rights. And I feel like, just let me give you an example. We have six people running for four positions for the school board in Monroeville, which is in Allegheny County. And that's where I've been focusing a lot lately. and we've been having some good success. But one of the guys running is a lawyer, and he uses all of his quote-unquote accomplishments as a lawyer as qualifications, when in actuality, to me and many of us, I think, maybe, but not enough of us, would see that as actually a detriment. And I want to find a way to really expose the Bar Association, because, for instance, in the school board meetings, there have been a number of occasions where even we, some of us who are not as knowledgeable about this, are fighting for the right and using good points. They're appealing to the school board association. And then one day it had dawned on me, who has guided or written the laws or procedures that this, the policies of the school board association of Pennsylvania? The lawyers. They're actually, we shouldn't be appealing to them. We've got the whole thing. We're so used to having elites ruling over us. And this is this particular woman who was appealing to the school board on our behalf, she was using it rightly. It's kind of like using statutes and codes against, you know, the government. But still, we need to get the bigger picture that these boards are not even something that the people should have. They're an obstacle to accomplishing, bringing back, you know, the law.
Well, the people themselves have got to come together to take control of everything, starting right into the schools and then coming down right to what goes on in our local government. And again, once you organize and get things together, you know, look at, we can save this nation county by county. One county does not need all 3,130 other counties to do the same thing in order to get justice, at least in their courts, and control of their local government, and to some degree, and of course, up to the county level at least. You know, we have to have county to counties working to really get some control over the state, and we have to have state to state working to really get control over the federal government. That's why we need to establish this in every county, or at least most counties, a majority of counties. Because remember, we have government by the majority that participates, and we can control them, and we have the power and the authority to remove these people from office. We don't have to become committeemen to do that. We have the power and authority to put these people onto the ballots. We don't have to become committeemen to do that. And that's why I'm kind of shying away from becoming committeeman, because it's too restrictive. It takes years. It'll take years to try to take control of that process, because we have to try to get people elected. And I've always been a little frustrated, personally, concerning that part of the process, that it takes so long to become a committeeman. And when you have to work towards it, and it may take the whole year to put it together, and then you get voted in for the following year, and you still don't have enough people because you got the enemy in there. And they usually overwhelm you with too many people, so you can't get anything done. So we have to ignore that whole thing. And besides that, I mean, you know, parties, our founders did not have anything to do with parties. Thomas Jefferson did not create a party, as we're being taught. None of our founding fathers were involved with parties, okay? That's something really that the elite has brought up. When we were reading this paper, it was back around 1730, I was trying to find it as you were talking, but around 1730, where the real first case of jury nullification, visited here, that we're aware of anyway, that visited here in the United States, and it was concerning the election of a particular governor and brought up criminal charges against that individual. And of course, you know, they already were controlling what was going on here in America, you know, talking about the British particularly. And I'm sure they were getting frustrated because America, you know, the colonies, the people of the colonies were becoming out of hand for them, out of control. And so they had to do something about it. And what they did is they created, the Bar Association was actually created, from my understanding and everything I've read, it was actually created first here in the United States. It was actually created, it was created to... In 1750, it was created for the sole purpose to take back control of the courts and to destroy this common law process that they had already been destroying in England.
Do you have a source for that, John?
Well, yeah, it's in our paperwork. It's in the book. We do have a source, and we refer back to the source, 1750. And I think we read it here in this particular paper, I think earlier on in one of the other parts. But it is in the book, and I'm sure we have it in various places. But as the Bar Association was created in order to destroy our court system, to destroy the common law. This came to such a problem because they weren't listening at anything that people had to say. And Benjamin Franklin even went to England, to Britain, in order to try to get an audience with the king and try to solve some of the problems. And he never got that audience, and he was just denied. And he was so frustrated with the problem. He had the newspaper going, and he was the biggest troublemaker for them. But they took control, and they continue to take control, and they were destroying our courts before we even became America. And it continues on. And the king and the pope got together, I think it was 1818, when they got together to make it clear that they were going to work together to plunder America, plunder our economic system, our political system, and our judicial system. And they've been working at this, and it is the bar that has been doing this. And by, I think it was 1878, somewhere around there, when the first American bar was finally established, and it continued on. And look what they've done to our courts. Common law is not heard. My brother went to law school. He never finished it, or he never became a lawyer anyway. He might have completed it. But one of the things he was telling me, and when he was telling me, he was believing it, and now he's changed his mind, of course. But he was being taught that they were trying to get rid of the juries, and really that the judges, educated individuals in the law, who become judges, are much more qualified than the people because they're ignorant to the law, their law, which is equity, which is positive law. It's strange that they call it positive law because it's not very positive at all. Although it is, if it is true equity, it is positive. You know, if it's under American jurisprudence, yeah, it is positive law. Positive law made by man, but it's equity, okay? Mm-hmm. And they of course robbed us of our courts of law. They've turned them into civil law courts. They claim to have combined equity and law, and because the common law was so unjust, so powerfully unjust, they claim. They actually have this written up on their on the website, the United States Supreme Court, in the process concerning the 1934 Rules Enabling Act. And so the whole thing has been, you know, look, the Revolutionary War never ended. We're starting to see the finale now. It's finally coming to a head to complete that process. And America thinks they won World War II. We did not win World War II. Mm-hmm. The complete infiltration of our nation by the end of the war had taken place. The White House was taken over. They already had control going all the way back to the turn of the century, the 20th century there. They already had control of the legislators and the legislative system. Working on the judicial process, and that was already pretty much destroyed. But by 1938, America was totally destroyed. The courts of America were totally destroyed. And rarely do you see any kind of justice in the courts. You can't say that it hasn't been there, because sometimes, of course, you do get it, but they've destroyed it. If people understood this, okay, I cannot see anywhere where the federal government has any authority to hold a criminal court case against one of the people in a federal court. I can't see it at all. Mm-hmm. Because the only authority they have on a criminal court case would be something under equity that turns criminal. And maybe there, of course, possibly, and I wonder about this too, you know, that they can continue that in their court, because of course you have U.S. attorneys who are students of equity, but of course it's civil law and a lot of problems. But nevertheless, if it was true equity, you know, they can apply the equity, which is the statutes, the regulations, and the codes, upon the people who are working for government agencies or involved in certain commercial activities or in certain commercial criminal activities. They can apply those codes and regulations against them, because it was agreed upon already. They've gotten certain powers and authorities, and and they agreed to the terms of equity. But the people have the power to nullify it. And yeah. But as far as courts of law, they have no power, no authority whatsoever. You know, if they want to bring a charge against an individual in any of the counties, within any of the states, they need to gather their evidence and go see the sheriff and bring it before the sheriff, and the sheriff will consider whether he or she will take it to the jury to see for an indictment. And if that sheriff decides to take it to the jury for a potential indictment, of course, then it's up to the jury to make that decision. But then it's up to the Pettit jury, if they are indicted and they do go to court, it's up to the Pettit jury whether the law is lawful, whether the law is just. You know, jurors are not, as we read here, they're not to really, apply the law in a court. They're to apply justice in the court. Mm-hmm. And often, more often than not, justice can be and should be, nullification of a law, you know, that these people make up and think that they have to control our behaviors.
Right.
So, you know, I think it was Eisenhower who said, you know, we will never control sin by making laws. But the true sin is the lawmaker. Because they're really trying to control on the people.
The true sin is that the people have had truth withheld from them. That's the real sin.
Absolutely. Yeah, no education, proper education in the schools.
Because the people knew it, then they would.
Ignorant.
If the people knew it, they would, like you said earlier, if the people knew, if we only knew, we don't need the school board association. We don't need so many of these ruling bodies. We can think for ourselves.
If the people understood this booklet, okay, they would understand the fact that they can take that whole system over and shut them down and force them to obey the people. And every community has the right and the authority to decide how they want things to go within their schools or in their community in other ways. It's up to the people. Again, this is called government by consent. Whatever action that government does, any action, we've given them the powers, we've given them the authority, we laid out the law for them, and when they violate that law or take that which is beyond what we have given them, we have the power and the authority under government by consent, if we're participating, to stop it and prevent it and end it. We can do that, okay? We can do that by removing these people from office. We can do that by indicting these people. And of course, the first step is to make contact with and again, we're setting the system up where the administrators representing the people would have the authority and the power not only to go into any government office to do an investigation on behalf of a grand jury, they also have the power and the authority to pass that, of course, to the jury themselves or any of the people that is being violated by an agency, a local agency, or maybe not one that's not necessarily local. But they have the power to make the phone call and say, hey, you know, we're going to send these people over because we want to see what's going on there, and we want to get into your books and your computer and end this stuff. Or whatever violation or refusal of information, a call to say, hey, give these people what they're asking for. Because they love to hold information. I mean, they hold the simplest of things. And if they don't do that, then we have the power to bring it before the grand jury and ask them to do something, and the grand jury can go and definitely get into that place to discover what's going on. And if they refuse, then, hey, they have the opportunity and the ability to indict and bring it into the court of law and let the people investigate and see exactly what's going on. So this is government by consent. We have to have the knowledge, and we have to exercise that knowledge, and we have to make sure our sheriffs have that knowledge and make sure they're exercising that knowledge. And without doing that, we cannot have liberty. We can't have America like we think it should be or think it is. And people don't really even know what true liberty is. They really don't understand.
Right.
I speak to myself first, of course, because I didn't know until I started looking into these things.
Well, we've become accustomed and we feel secure and safe in our chains.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let me move to the next person. Appreciate the talk and the questions.
I appreciate your answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Okay, let's take Ross. How you doing, Ross? Good to see you again.
Hi, John. I'm wondering, Can we also eliminate the resolve too, if we have the joy?
Eliminate what?
The Federal Reserve.
Oh, the Federal Reserve. Yeah, I think that's going to happen without the people doing anything. I think the military is going to end that because it has to end. It's part of the New World Order. It's part of the destructive part of. They're robbing the people. They're thieves. As a matter of fact, they are the mafia. They organize crime. And they're the funders, you know, again, we get back to the minions of the New World Order who have created the control of the whole money system, the whole process, and the protection of all these thieves and murderers, these criminals, these subverters. The whole system is corrupt, and I think there's lots of indictments coming down, and that's all part of that process. And I do believe,
see,
and there's only one just thing here that can happen once we take them down, and I do believe it's going to happen, and that is the seizure of everything, which is probably 80% or more of the entire world, ultimately. I mean, they control so much, the gold, the silver. They control the properties and or businesses. They control the news media. And they control so much, probably about 80% and probably more than that of the entire economy of probably the whole world, not just the United States. And so if we take that back, that's trillions of dollars. And where does that money go? Where the government takes it? No, that would be unjust, wouldn't it? It has to go back to the people. It's got to go back. We have been beaten down and destroyed. Our parents have been destroyed. Our grandparents have been destroyed. Our great-great-grandparents and so on, going all the way back for quite some time, especially since the Federal Reserve has come to be. But the assault has been around.
Yeah.
Since the revolution.
Think about it happened in the same situation in ancient Rome with the Julius Caesar that got killed on the steps of the Senate, steps of Rome.
Yeah, we're going.
She gave the gives out of the thing to the. He wanted to give the power to the Roman people over the money supply. The central bankers or money changers didn't like that, you know. And they killed him. That's why.
Well, one of the major heads. One of the major heads of Leviathan, the beast, is. You know, spiritually talking, because remember, you know, the Bible teaches us that Satan is prince and power of the air. He won this world by conquest. Of course, he lost it at the cross, but nevertheless, the application of that defeat will be applied at the end as we come to the end. But nevertheless, the point is that the Federal Reserve is one of the heads of the beast. To cut that head off would totally destroy. That system, at least here in America, and it wouldn't destroy the beast because that goes even further. We have to get to the elite, the top, those the powers that be, so to speak, and I refer to that as Leviathan. The Bible speaks of Leviathan.
I know. Yes, I think the problem with that is a lot of the people on the top. Like the banking elites and the circuit elites are so in control of everything, they don't want to give it up.
Right. Well, there's a couple of hundred families that actually control the entire world. Okay. And,
That is the Rothschild family.
Well, Rothschild.
In France and Germany.
The Warburg, I mean, you know, there's quite a few families, but only a couple of hundred. And you know, again, I see justice coming to all of them. You know, even the Queen of England and that whole royal family thing, the Rockefellers here, you know, those are just to name a few, you know. But I do see all that falling soon, and I see that happening from the military, because look, we're at war, and when we get injured in courts and we get injured in this whole process, we are casualties of war ultimately, because they're out there, their ammunition is the injustice in their courts particularly, and their monopoly money system that is destroying the economy.
Yeah, I think, have the British military investigated the warrior family too? Or they own that military?
That's a good question. I have knowledge of that, but I know the people all around and some people in that government and, of course, our government and many other governments. Once it goes down, look at, once the United States destroys it here, okay, and remember, we have built many, many democracies over the past, 70 years or so. You know, we've been building maybe more than that. We've been building democracies. Democracies, every time we create a democracy, it's preparation for really the first part to become an oligarchy. Democracies always fail, and they always end up becoming an oligarchy and are destroyed. Once the United States kills it off and assists in many of those democracies that we've built, because a lot of the people that are just and want justice, they will destroy it themselves within their nations and countries, shall I say, and we will assist them, I'm sure. And I see it worldwide, and there is a prophecy that speaks about that very thing when it's destroyed, the evil within the governments of the world. I believe it's Isaiah 14.
Yeah, how about
14.
The World Bank?
That's Bank. Another evil. Yeah, again, another evil owned by the elitists, you know? So, mm-hmm. Okay. All right, anything else, Ross?
Not right for right now.
Okay, thanks for the call. All right, we'll take our last caller before we go back into our program here. It looks like Linda from Virginia. Let me click on the button. You got the mic. Go right ahead, Linda.
You can hear me?
We can hear you.
Okay. I'm calling about an issue and an ongoing issue, and it's probably going to be a little hard to describe, but anything you can weigh in with. I have a question about it, though. Mm-hmm. Basically, the state came after me for taxes, and the difficult thing is I owe part of the taxes. I don't have a problem with that, and I'd actually like to probably pay it off.
What state?
But Virginia. Mm-hmm. Commonwealth of Virginia.
And you're talking about an income tax, a state income tax?
Yeah, state income tax. Uh-huh.
Well, you do know that that's unlawful, right?
What's that?
You do know the state income tax is unlawful.
On what?
A state income tax, federal income tax, that's all unconstitutional. That's called a direct tax.
I know all that. And
I'm very surprised that the state is chasing you, because I've been chased by the state and they never went anywhere with it. They were really just a paper tiger. You know, they threaten you and they do all these things, but they never end up bringing you into court. And I don't want to say that they won't, because they've really gotten bad and who knows how far the evil will go. But have they gotten to the point with taking you to court? Because, again, they usually pass...
No, none of that. None of that. They just threatened, you know, liens and stuff like that. But they've not taken action. And because I did owe some of it...
Well,
you
don't really owe anything. Just imagine if you had a constitutional sheriff who understood this. Imagine what they can do to prevent and protect you. They couldn't even touch you. If they understood this, what we're talking about, they understood what we just read tonight, okay? And again, there's much, much more with the book that I've written. It's 900 pages, and it was written to liberate people. It was written to liberate the mind. And I had my mind and my thought ultimately when I was pushing this book out, not only to get to the people, but really to focus on the sheriffs, because they're the ones with the power and the authority, and we need to educate them as soon as possible. But imagine what would you wouldn't have no fear. You know, all these unlawful foreclosures, they're called non-judicial foreclosures, Every foreclosure that takes place, whether it is the mortgage foreclosure or whether it is a tax foreclosure, they're all of them are non-judicial foreclosures because they don't have a way to take it to the court in a proper way for the people can get due process because they fail immediately. You can shut them right down because the law is against them. And so they do these non-judicial foreclosures. And then who goes out and settles it? The sheriff. If the sheriff understood that that was all unlawful and he's participating in a crime without his realization, he would stop. And that's how important it is to educate our sheriffs. And you know, well, I've heard some people say, well, you know, my sheriff's evil, my sheriff's this, and my sheriff's that. You know, that may be so. There is a handful, I'm sure, throughout. You got 3,000 plus sheriffs. You know there are some criminals in there, of course. I don't know what the percentage of that might be. Could it be 10%? I don't think it's that high. It could be. I don't know. But the bottom line is a lot of sheriffs may appear to be wrong and evil and participating only because of their ignorance of the law. I hear from sheriffs over and over again, you know, I don't know these things. You know, I wasn't taught these things. Sheriff Dar talks about that kind of thing. The sheriffs are not taught these things. They don't know. They're taught the civil law. They're taught the process of statutes, the statutory process. And, you know, just imagine if the sheriffs understood that all these traffic courts, and some people go to jail in traffic courts, all of these civil charges, especially any case that comes through a town court, a village court, any of those cases, okay, they're all unlawful. They don't have the power. They're not courts of records, and only a court of record can incarcerate. And so, therefore, if the sheriff understood that, as these courts are sending people in, he'd be letting them go, saying, we're not taking them. We're not going to let them bring them into the jail. You're an unlawful court. There is no due process in that court. If they just think of the liberty just for the sheriff to know the law. Unbelievable. We have to
learn.
This is how important our campaign is.
Addressing my issue launching a full frontal attack on the tax issue is two different things. And I don't have a problem with that, but anyway, my understanding, okay, so the state is not the IRS, right?
Mm-hmm, correct.
And they don't, and so I've read things that say they're basically just a debt collector, you know?
They don't have the structure, actually. Not to say they wouldn't create one and they haven't tried to do something, but they really don't have the structure to really come out and get the people for the taxes. They depend on the feds to do all of that stuff and the ultimate collections that go through when you do your taxes. But then
my understanding is that they do have certain powers that they can come after you. And
well,
so there's that whole gray area, you know.
Yeah,
they're unlawful
powers because they'll apply liens without due process. You see, the only way you can beat them or deal with them is, number one, the way you could deal with them and get out from underneath them is work a deal and pay it off. That's one way. But for people who don't want to deal with them and pay them off, then they need to go get educated and understand how this whole system works with what they're doing. I did some really good research on the IRS and their system, and I've beaten them in a couple occasions. But I'm back in court with them. But you see, the thing is, they don't take me to court. I take them to court. Before they even have the opportunity to do it, I take them to court. And if you find, look at, one of the things I realized is since there is no direct taxes, it's really, there's something wrong. There's some, you know, game with words going on. I knew that without even knowing the words and knowing what exactly it was. So all I did was starting to look down. They'll make a claim of some code or something, you know, let's take the feds with the IRS, you know, USC 26, and they'll say this, that, or the other thing, and it applies to you. And you go look at it, well, you start climbing down that rabbit hole. Because law is constructive. It's a construction of law, one statute upon another, the meaning of the words, the phrases. It's like a maze, a web or something going down, okay? And you start to look at the meaning of these things. I took their codes and laid it out in the court, and they just don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear that stuff because it showed clearly that the people have no responsibility, or whatever better word, I don't know, but to pay these things. They're not liable, that's a better word. They have no liability to them at all. And if I brought this before a jury, okay, and showed them reading their law, hands down, you'd win.
Okay, so my issue is that there's 1 year that, okay, they sent me a bill for $10,000.
Wow.
I sent a dispute back, and I disputed it, and they immediately, this was right before the election, so I think they were revenue hunting.
Mm-hmm.
So they immediately reduced it to $5,000, just like that,
yeah,
in half.
Because they can't prove it to begin with.
But there's still a year on there that I don't owe. And I could go into that, but, you know,
I'll tell you what, if you're willing to pay them off to get rid of them, because sometimes maybe that's the thing. I mean, I go to traffic court from time to time, you know, and I usually, a lot of times they don't bother me anymore. I write a paper, I file it up, then if you hear from them anymore. But, you know, sometimes I go in. I've been maybe half the time one way and half the time the other way. And sometimes I have to go in because they don't go for my paperwork, and I look at the amount of time I have to spend and everything, and the fine that they're giving me, you know, for whatever it is, usually traffic violation, of course, and I just pay it and move on. But now I've drawn the line. I'm not doing it no more.
Right. I have a real problem with paying something I don't owe.
Right.
The year that I don't owe actually has to do, I filed bankruptcy over 10 years ago. And I had to pay, it was a Chapter 13, I had to pay every month for 5 years. And I took the hit on bankruptcy. It was a long time. And so...
Well, in bankruptcy, they claim, you know, in bankruptcy, they got a clauses in there that you can't file bankruptcy with the taxes. I don't know about state.
No, you can't. You can. Yeah. You can't. I know people think that, but you can with the Chapter 13.
Well, in the state, you might be able to get away with the feds. They don't care. So if it's a state...
No, it was feds. It was feds.
Well, I'm surprised with that.
No,
well,
you can. You absolutely can. You have to have... You can't file the past 2 years, but you can file anything before that.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be a Chapter 13. You have to go on a payment plan.
Yeah, I'm not aware that there may be some stuff in there that I haven't seen, and they try to apply.
I did it. It's absolutely true.
Okay.
So, and that was the main reason I did it. I didn't have any other debts except for federal and state taxes.
Have you thought about writing a letter to the individual who is communicating with you, and you say, look, I'm willing to pay this and that because...
I already made up a whole package. Here's the catch on it. You pay the payment plan for 5 years, and then whatever's left gets written off. So this year that they're trying to claim was supposed to be written off.
Mm-hmm.
But they're coming, what they're doing is they're coming back and they're saying that I didn't file my taxes for that year. And the way it works is when you file for bankruptcy, you have to have filed your taxes every year. And my attorney I had to provide tax copies to my attorney for every year for the taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But this was for 2006, of all things, 2006. So we're going back 15 years.
Wow. And
I could have,
they're just recently pursuing you for 2006?
Yes, last year. Last year.
Because I thought that there was some statutes that prevented them from only going back so far. I could be wrong on that, but I thought I
That's a shady gray area, too. I did bring that up, though. I did bring the statute of limitations up, but... Mm-hmm. So, but the catch is that in order for me to have filed the Chapter 13, I would have had to file my taxes for every year. And like I said, I provided copies to my attorney. And then in 2009, the state of Virginia actually came to me and said, told me that I hadn't filed my taxes for that year. And you know when this was, when they first started filing online?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think it was, I can't be sure, but I'm not 100%, but I think it was the first year I tried to file online.
So you don't have this paperwork for back then, therefore?
Yes, I do. I do. I have copies.
Oh,
and so when
okay.
they came to me in 2009, I sent them a copy. I said, yes, I filed. Here it is. Here's the copy.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then I never heard anything again until last year. I feel like somebody is just going back through the records and digging this up, you know. But anyway.
Well, they're always doing that, trying to make more money. And, you know, once you become a troublemaker, though, and they realize that you know the game, and the jig is up, you know, they usually, you know, leave you alone. For me,
well, they have, and they send me these things, and they're not signed by anyone. It has a thing at the bottom that says client, and it has a number, like six numbers. You know,
mm-hmm.
so you don't even know who's handling it, who's doing this. But anyway, I sent them a whole package telling them all this. I said, I've filed my taxes every year. Why wouldn't I have filed for that year? There was nothing unique happened that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I told them that in order for me to have filed the Chapter 13, I had to make sure that I filed every
year. Why don't you sue them? I had a very...
Well, that's what I'm trying to get to ask you.
Yeah, let me just tell you a little story before you go on, because I had something similar with that with the unemployment people. And they were assaulting me that I owed them all kinds of money and everything. I mean, they just made all this stuff up. And so, you know, I did call a lawyer and talk with a lawyer. And they said, just go to the administrative process, you know, and you can appeal it. And then at some point, you know, if you don't win there, you can still take it into the state court. And so, of course, I trusted the lawyer. This is long before I had any real education. But I did have, you know, I had understanding of the court a little bit because I was a contractor. And I've been in court on numerous occasions representing myself with people who didn't pay me. But so I went through that process, and what a horrible, evil thing in that place. I mean, they just don't care about nothing. They make things up, and they're just so unjust. I mean, I had some good points and good care, but they didn't want to hear it. And they told me, the Constitution, that doesn't even
apply. Right, that's what they did. I made up this whole package, and they came back with a little letter saying, we decided that it stands, and you still owe the money. That's basically what it said.
If you did that, then what I'm going to finish telling you has something to do, but, there's, you know, again, we can take a different approach on it. But at the end of the day, I said, well, okay, I'm going to take this into the state court, New York State. So I tried to take it into the court, and they rejected it. They said, whoa, you lost in administrative court. Before you could take it back into the court, you got to pay that money. They refused to hear the case until I paid that money. So the whole thing, you know, that was really bad advice from a lawyer. And, from that point, I know I would just take it directly into the state court because you can win it in the state court, okay? And if you demand a jury trial,
When you say state court, are you just talking about going down to the local court and filing? Or are you talking about going...
Here in New York, it's called the Supreme Court, okay? We go to the Supreme Court in the state here. And the Supreme Court every single county, like the New York State or Supreme Court, County of Dutchess, County of Orange, County, whatever county you're in, every county has a Supreme Court where you go and file cases. That's where you don't want to go to the county court.
I think it's different. I think
that
the reason I'm getting confused, I think it's different here. I think every county...
Every state does have a little thing, but you do have a state court in every county.
Every county has a circuit court here.
That's probably your state court then. And you're
okay. I just didn't know because I have filed a Supreme Court appeal to the state of Virginia. That's different. That's in Richmond.
Okay, well, I don't know if Brent is listening to this conversation. I see he's in the room. If he wants to pipe in on that, he would have the knowledge.
Well, let me ask you something real quick.
Yeah.
I saw your letters, the validation and verification letters, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in another another place that talks about trusts and things that I listened to, they were talking about declaratory judgments.
Mm-hmm.
And they were saying that a declaratory judgment is better than an affidavit because you actually get a judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So should I try either one of those?
Well,
you know, before
judgment ultimately is, you know, the court will declare, it depends on what you're asking, what your wherefore clause is. And if you're looking for a declaratory judgment, that's what you put into your wherefore clause. But I would go beyond that. You know, I would, they're assaulting you. They've damaged you. They put you under stress and pressure. They've refused to give you true due process. So I would try to take it into the state court. Now, you may have a problem trying to, for them saying, well, you got to first pay before you come in. You may have that problem. But you can make the argument and say, well, I can refute that. I have a case.
For me to file a case in circuit court, it cost me like $75.
Well, it's more than that here in New York. But I hear.
I don't mind that.
You've been in administrative court, though?
I don't think we have administrative court.
Okay, so you have not been in an administrative court, which is an administrative hearing. It's a hearing. The guy's not even a judge.
I don't know what that would be. I don't even know how to go to the state and say, what's your appeal process? I don't even know what that is.
Well, I can't get them to tell me. Well, look, have you gone to a hearing?
No, we don't have anything like that.
Okay. Well, I'm sure they all have that. But nevertheless, that's okay. That's a good thing then. Then, yeah, I would definitely pay the $75 and go into a court and open a court of record. But, of course, you have to have the ability and the knowledge to do that. I don't know that you'll get a lawyer that'll go up against the state claiming, you know, an argument against taxes. But, although you might, because you can prove.
What would be my case? Just disputing the bill that they're...
Exactly. If you can prove and show the paperwork, they need to deal with that. And you can.
You know, I told them in that package, I said, I have sent you a copy of this filing 3 different times. So how can you still say that I haven't filed for that year? Even if I
have
didn't.
Have you thought about going up to the next person involved? There's always a supervisor and a
supervisor. I don't know who that is.
Well,
I don't know who.
Just ask them. Say, hey, buddy, who's your supervisor? I want to talk with that person.
There's nobody to ask. All you do is get these notices.
Okay, well, then now you go to your representative and see if you can get them to do anything. You know, you have the representative within your state. There's assembly. I know here in New York.
I was thinking about that. I was thinking about going to a representative and saying, you know.
Right. And bring it to them and ask them if they can help you. It's very simple. You just ask, hey, can you help me with this? This is a problem with a bureaucrat. The other thing is try to get an audience with a grand jury.
You know, all the representatives here are Democrats. So that's
it doesn't
one
matter.
Issue.
The thing is they're looking for your vote. If they see not all Democrats are unjust and unrighteous, and you know,
right?
There's a lot of them, of course, with compassion and so on. And they may even be doing some criminal activities, and they don't even see it as a criminal activity anymore.
Well, so I'm just hoping some of them aren't too bad, but I'm just hoping Youngkin wins.
Well, look, they're looking for your vote anyway, and you go talk to them. Then they know if they do help you, they're probably going to. They think they're going to get your vote. So, and so just go to find your representative and go to that within the state representative and make contact with that office and write something, a simple letter explaining things and ask if you can actually come in and talk with them about it. But see what they can do, because that's one avenue you can go. The final avenue that'll settle the whole thing, in my opinion, is the court itself. Even if a judge was to make a ruling on this case, but I wouldn't allow a judge to make a ruling on that case. And the other side, when they see you going into a jury and pushing the jury.
But, you know, the courts are so corrupt. I mean, aren't they just going to toss it out?
Well,
they're going to dismiss it?
In a lot of cases, they will. Okay, it depends. Look, this sounds like a case you might be able to win, because you're not really making an argument that you're not paying taxes, or you're making the argument,
no,
I
not
paid
at all.
The tax and leave me alone, because you're badgering me and you're threatening.
In fact, we're not talking about a lot of money here. It's like a few hundred dollars for each year, you know. But mm-hmm. this one year, it's like $2,500. And that's why I have
I don't think it's enough money for them to really try to chase you. I truly do not believe they will dare take you to a court. And if they tried to go out to take your money without due process, and they might try to do that, you know, here's one of the things, I don't know if the state, how it works with the state, but with the federal government, if the IRS is going to seize, and they do obey this process, if the IRS is going to seize your money, they give you a 7-day notice. I mean, not only did they give me a 7-day notice by mail, they actually came knocking on my door to verbally give me that 7-day notice saying, we are going to seize your property. We are going to file this lien. Immediately I filed a papers. I sued everybody. I sued the commissioner of the IRS commissioner. I think that was the title commissioner. I sued the IRS agents. I sued the sheriff. And I sued the county clerk, okay? And the reason I sued all those people is because they were all frozen from doing anything to me while it's in court. And I took it into the federal court, and I won.
They have been able, this is basically extortion. They have been able to just say this with no evidence, nothing.
That's what they do. Look, you have a couple of solutions here, okay? I do not think that they'll ever take you to court. I think you can ignore it, and I think it'll just fall away. That's one solution. Another solution is of course, to take it into the court. Another solution, well, a solution before that, before spending money, is to take it to your representative. Okay, so those are two ways you can go. Of course, you can pay it off.
You don't think the validation and verification would have any value at all, like doing something like that?
Well, what do you mean when you say that? What's the process?
Well, making them prove.
They're not gonna prove nothing to you if they're ignoring you and badgering you right now. They're just gonna continue to assault you, and they will not even try to approve. You have to force them to prove it. And the only way you're gonna force them to prove it is ultimately that could be done through a representative who get involved with this and say what's going on here. Look at they got the papers or the. You know, the information that you've paid, here it is. What are you doing? That's a possibility. Okay, again, taking it into court is another possibility. I would open a court of record. And again, if they started to make the argument and pursue in the court, which I think they would settle with you because they're only going to be exposed if you understand the process of what they're doing to take your money, which is unlawful.
I started looking at offering compromise and hardship type things and all that, and somebody told me though that they used to do that and they're hardly ever approving those anymore, so mm-hmm. that's why I kind of backed off from that.
Again, I think you got two or three options here, and I think those are the only options. I mean, I can't think of anything else, and I think you could win. I do not believe they're going to want to go to court because they can't make a defense. Okay, you've got the proof. Okay, mm-hmm. and I'll
well,
tell you
actually,
what.
No,
hold
that,
on, hold on,
that was
hold
the
on,
other
hold
thing
on.
I was.
Hold on, let me make this other point. By you going to court and writing a good wherefore clause, you have been injured. You're looking for money from all these people, the individuals. You're looking for money from them because they have to pay you restitution. You know, I think of restitution, you know, depending on the violation and how serious it might be in different areas. The restitution for violating my unalienable rights, at least $10,000 per incident, per individual, and it becomes a conspiracy.
Yeah, they're actually keeping me from paying this off because I don't want to pay the part I don't owe. So
right.
In the meantime, it's accumulating, you know how they do. They accumulate interest and fees
right.
or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm. And so, but here's the thing. Like I said, this was back when we weren't filing online and we just like sent it in like you just went to the post office and
mm-hmm.
you mailed your taxes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so on one hand they don't have any evidence, but I don't really have any evidence either except to say I've submitted it three different times.
Right, but you don't have
a
copy of the filing.
I do.
Okay, well that's your evidence.
Yeah, I absolutely. That's the copy that I have provided to them.
Okay, well,
three
look
different times.
This is what I would do if I were you. You've already provided to them, and I would do a notice and demand to begin with. Okay, it's an 8-point process. I don't know. You know, you get to make 8 points inside the notice and demand. We do have information on that up on our website, and but whatever it is that you do, you have to make sure you do by affidavit. Okay. In other words, whatever letter you write, make sure you put the necessary statement on the bottom for a notary, and you do it by affidavit. The other thing is you make sure you serve it directly to the individual. You could
well,
do that.
Well, this other group is saying, that this declaratory judgment is better than an affidavit.
I don't understand what they mean by a declaratory judgment. If a judge gets a judgment, you can get a declaratory
that's
judgment.
That's what I wanted to tell you, though. This sounds like a better way to go than an affidavit, because you actually get a judgment.
No, well, look at who's going to give you the judgment.
I believe it's by default.
Well, again, if they default, that's where a notice and demand comes in, okay? And you look at the notice and demand. We got all the verbiage up there. You know, you just have to put your information.
Maybe we're talking about the same thing.
Maybe that's the only way, because once you file it with them, at the end of the paperwork, it is, if you don't do this and you don't do that, this is what I'm going to do, and blah 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 blah. You know, you should be able to take that and use it as a default. You go file it down to the court itself and file it as a default. Now, you have to still go into the court to file it, so you have to pay that $75 to go through that process, because then the judge, that gives you the final word. But
yeah, I don't care about that.
A declaratory judgment, to my understanding, is you're asking a judge to declare a certain thing. That's what I understand a declaratory judgment to. And that was inside what's called
I wish was
court.
I wish Brent was there so he could tell us.
Well, he is here. And when I don't know, Brent, you want to comment on this? If you're paying attention here at the moment? He'll unmute if he's listening in at the moment.
I'm not really clear on the difference of a notice and demand and
a notice and demand. Look at a notice and demand, when I do notice and demands, the final process, if they just ignore me, is then I take it to the court and I file a paper in the court and give a wherefore clause, and ultimately I'm already, the default has taken place, and I'm making a note into the court that default has taken place, serve all the papers, and then take that and file it for a judgment in the county, and then take it to the sheriff for execution. And again, I'd be looking for money. Now, I'll tell you what. Here's what I do believe and think. If you take the paperwork, and you've already done that, and if you haven't done it in an affidavit form, you need to do it in an affidavit form. And you also have to mail it to them in a way that you get a return receipt. It's got to be certified return receipt if possible. And then the other thing is you shouldn't put it in the mailing. You should get someone else to do it for you, and then they do an affidavit of service, okay? You know, you can go to your sheriff. Your sheriff may serve it. There's a lot of places the sheriff only charge you $25. I mean, I've paid as much as $60, but, you know, they serve for a minimal amount, $20-$25. You can find a server also, but the sheriff is the best way to go. And you have it served to the sheriff. And once that's done, no, you just sit on it and forget about it. They can do everything they want. If they try to make a move at that point.
So make an affidavit and have it served on them.
You an affidavit, absolutely. I would do a notice and demand in affidavit form, or you could do whatever you're writing in the paperwork with your proof in affidavit form and then serve it, yes. Because then they've been served and notified. And the bottom line, leave me alone, okay? That's the bottom line. And then at that point, if anything, they're not going to come out after you for that, after that point, because they should know that they're not going to win against you. Because remember, that bureaucrat then who is badgering you, in order to pursue it in court, has to go to the county attorney, okay? And they have to bring that stuff to the county attorney. The county attorney says, well, they already paid it.
You know, one thing I noticed about that, like I said, the things, they don't have any signatures. They're just form letters.
Yeah.
And they don't identify anybody, and they put this client number on there. I'm wondering if they're, like, hiring people who somehow get like a commission on, you know, like collection or whatever, and
that's
who we're ultimately dealing with is some, you know, high school kid or something. You know, I don't know,
the IRS has moved into that direction, and they hire another agency. The IRS is really a collection agency to begin with, and when they know that they can't defeat you, like with my case, they turn it over to a collection agency. And then they try to go after with that. I sued the collection agency, I sued the IRS, and I went in for collusion and conspiracy and all that stuff. I'm still in court with them for all that. I'm looking for a lot of money for that. And I also have defaults. The U.S. attorneys have defaulted on their side. But in any event, the point is if you do a notice and demand, go find, get information. We have it up on our website on notice
and demand. Yeah, I'll look for it.
Okay, it should be under education. And you should find it in here, court forms, process, and instructions, right
there. And that's something I file directly with them?
Yeah, follow the instructions on a notice and demand. It's like going to court without paying the fee. When I first learned the system, and I would go after someone for money, because I was a contractor, I was able to do what's called a mechanics lien. So I'd do a mechanics lien, and I'd renew it, okay? Then what I would do is I'd go down to the court, okay, and I would get what's called an index number. Here in New York, you pay so much for an index number, then you pay so much to go into the court, okay? So I would go and get the index numbers. I don't want a judge to be deciding it, so I didn't even file that part of the fee. I just filed for the index number. Once I get the index number, now a court case has been opened, okay? That's what the index number gives you. This is a court case, it's open. And then you write your papers, and you file it to the, you serve it on the people. And if they don't respond, then you don't have to do anything more in the courts. It's done. You go right down to the clerk. You give them an affidavit of default, and you give them a copy of the paperwork that you filed and the proof of service that you served them, and you file it with, and they have to just believe you, okay? You're not going to lie because it's a crime if you do. So they're going to believe you, and they're going to right there and then, they're going to give you the paper, put the seal on, you take it down to the sheriff and get execution. That's it. Done deal. Now, if you do this, they may also now say, well, it's time for us to deal with this person and let this go. And that's what I would do. See if you can get an index number without having to pay the whole thing to go into the court.
Well, see, that's why I brought up the declaratory judgment.
That's called the default. Look, a declaratory judgment is a judge making the declaration for you. You're seeking a declaratory judgment by a judge. In other words, you're not looking for...
But I think the thing is, they can't say no. I think if you file an affidavit, what does an affidavit do? Nothing, really. It doesn't do anything.
No, affidavit rules the court. An affidavit proves your case. An unrebutted
affidavit... Yeah, but
an affidavit,
I can make up an affidavit today, like right now. It doesn't do anything.
Sure it
doesn't
it
do
does.
Anything.
An unrebutted affidavit sets as truth in a court, period.
I have to go file a suit, file the affidavit,
right.
and then file an action.
Look, an affidavit is very powerful because it makes you serious to the person. You're swearing to it, and they're not swearing anything. They don't even rebut it because they can't rebut it. You understand? If you have the truth and the documents to prove that truth, they can't even rebut it. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. They have to deal with you, and if they don't, they're really stupid. And I would put in a wherefore clause that seeks damages, and the damages is a violation for every one of your unalienable rights that have been violated, the right of due process to begin with, okay? The refusal to answer your notice and demand, because that's the affidavit form I would use. All of this is evidence and more power and authority against these people. Now, it is true you can get into court and you have a judge that is just crooked and knows the people and whatever is going to protect the government, of course. But in some of these cases, it's just not worth it for them doing that. This is not a big deal. The judge isn't going to put his rear end on the line for this, I don't think. But the bottom line, if you open a court of record up and the judge makes a decision and he goes against you, whoa, what are you talking? You can't do nothing. It's a court of record. I'm looking for a jury. Didn't you read the papers? You see, there's a ways... I think this is a simple case. I think they'll just go away if you just go through the process going through a notice and demand. Go look it up. And then look at the notice and demand. Like I said, you then file it with the court, and you give them a file of paper, you know, You know, they have to answer on why they didn't answer your paper. They've already defaulted on that, so they can't even respond to that. And then that's the final thing to take into, and you're not even to go to court. You don't even see a judge. You just take the default that they default. Because the lawyer, once you're pushing them to get a lawyer involved, the lawyer's going to look to see what's going on and say, what are you doing? We're not going to win this case.
It really sounds to me like almost the same thing, but I guess we'd have to have somebody to tell us the difference. But
I don't know
okay,
exactly.
So I'm going to do that.
Who's going to make the declaratory judgment on you then? Who are you looking for to get the declaration?
No, this is a group. He has the How to Win in Court Without a Lawyer, and they advocate.
He's talking about going into the court, though.
They advocate trust. They advocate trusts a lot.
Such thing, in my understanding, of a declaratory judgment that doesn't come from a court. Okay.
Oh yeah, it comes from the court, but it sounds like a simpler process. I don't know. I just don't know the difference.
The only difference between a declaratory judgment and another judgment, usually, generally speaking, is you're going into court to make the judge to declare something. That's a declaratory judgment. Or you're going into the court maybe to make them to declare something and look for damages. And that's within you. And I wouldn't waste my time going to court just for a declaratory judgment. I'm going in for blood. You've injured me. You've put me under stress. You kept me under stress for a long time. You violated this right, that right, and the other right. I want $10,000 for every incident, for every individual involved. And you could find a whole list of people involved in this if you start digging around. Okay? And that would shake them up. If you start that process off with a
okay,
notice
well,
and demand.
I'm gonna do the notice and demand, and I'll keep you posted.
Yeah,
I want to ask you on a different note. I don't know if you remember my background, but code enforcement came after me. You all helped me. I'm forever thankful. But now I finished it, finalized it. It's all done. But I'm trying to do, catch up because I put some stuff on the back burner, and now I'm trying to do that stuff. You cannot find anybody to do anything. I'm serious. I've watched it get, I did this over, 10 years, and I've watched it get worse. And it is so bad. Homeowners cannot, all we get is no-shows, or scammers that want a fortune, mm-hmm. And so you're spending. I'm not exaggerating. You cannot find anybody to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're all. I don't blame them. I used to be able to get the Spanish people, and thank God for them. But you can't even get them now because they're all working for big companies, making good money, and nobody wants to fool around with these little. I need some plumbing done. I need a foundation wall put in. But all these are small jobs, and they come out looking for big jobs. And so now I'm sitting here. I've already been terrorized by code enforcement, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, my gosh, what is going to happen? Homeowners can't get anything done.
Well,
you know,
look, can shake them up in many different ways. I mean, I don't know that you have success all the time, but again, a lot of times they'll default or they'll just go away if you start to understand the system and respond to them with knowledge of the process. That's the key to this whole thing, understanding what it is they're doing and exposing them on how they're assaulting you and that it's unlawful. And
oh, no, I'm not talking about that. I'm not talking about that
I know
anymore.
You're talking about a code enforcer for something with construction that they're giving you a violation in the code, right?
Well, I'm not talking about anything right now, but I'm talking about just trying to get stuff done and how bad the industry is.
Yeah, I would never go to get a bar attorney, that's for sure. I would always represent myself if I were to hire a lawyer. Yeah, and by the way, I just want to make a statement here because someone corrected me last week about the difference between a lawyer and an attorney. And I never really looked too deep in it. I kind of thought, attorneys are bar attorneys and lawyers could be either or. But I went to look into it, and they're the same. It's synonymous. Black's law and Bouvier's law, the word attorney and the word lawyer is synonymous. Okay, so it doesn't even make any sense trying to make an argument of the meaning of the word, in my opinion, at this point. But I understand why people were trying to make that opinion, because I, at that point, and I've made the statements before in error. But in any event, I would never, ever, ever, ever go into a court and battle anything without running my own case. Nobody knows my case more than better than me. I know the facts. Now, I might hire an attorney or a lawyer, whatever you want to call them, as an advisor, as counsel. I might do that in certain cases. Okay, you know, I get involved in contract law because I'm a contractor, and I, you know, usually we have a contract, and it has the AIA standards, and that's the architects and the general contractors, you know, negotiated an agreement and conditions of construction, and so I use that. That's a contract, and I apply that into the case, and there might be some phrases in there that I might want to talk to an attorney about or a counselor, but I know that particular stuff pretty good because I've been in it for over 40 years, you know. But you know, again, I would never hire a lawyer to go argue my case or anything. Only get counsel off them, and maybe, you know, in order to work the system, especially today the way it is, if they would work certain paperwork for me to move me through the process, that would help to grease the wheels to get in, because once they see someone coming in what they call, quote-unquote, pro se, all of a sudden they put up all these blocks and barriers and hoops, and it's just, you know. But again, I've been through a lot of this already, so I kind of know the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I brought up the labor, you know, problem in my case early on, because I could already see that it was a problem, and I was already having problems getting work done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gotten 10, you know, it's now 10 times worse than what it was.
I will look at, do a notice and demand on that other case thing, and let us know how you make it out. And if you need any advice or thoughts on it, you can talk to us next Monday. And I'll look up the notice and demand and kind of brief through it myself, so I'm kind of familiar again with the, you know, the points. There are 8 points to be made in a notice and demand, and it's a very, very powerful, powerful instrument, extremely powerful. So powerful that if you get a just judge, immediately as soon as you go into court, they've already defaulted. You'll see it, and that's it. Done. Okay? And of course, if they default again a second time, you got a double default. You don't even have to see a judge at that point. You're going right. You only need that one final default once you file the index number, which puts you into the court process. But it doesn't actually take you into the court yet. But it's the process of argument. Once you
where they're trying to bill me for something that's not valid.
It's also called a show cause. Okay, mm-hmm. So let's talk next week or something about it. Go look at the notice and demand, ask us questions and thoughts, and we'll give you some thoughts and ideas, and take that process along. That's the cheapest way to go. That may just rough them up enough that they'll deal with you before you even take the second step. But even if you don't take the second step, once that's done, I'd kick back and don't worry, because they're not going to be able to do anything to you. Because even if they would get to the point once you hear words that they're going to take you to court, you better go file that court system first. And remember,
I did talk to a CPA, a good friend from years back, and he told me that he said, you have to keep on them, keep on them, keep on. He said, even I do with my clients, you know.
Well, anytime they send you a letter, you have to respond to that. Never let a letter from a government agency.
And thank you for that, because I just from listening, that has been drilled into me, and you are so right about that, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you can finalize that letter writing. You can finalize that assault by doing a notice and demand.
Right.
You know? All right, I got to get going because we have been so long on this.
All right, thank you so much.
Hopefully it's been interesting to all the people. Brent, if you're here, you can take the mic. If not, we'll just open up for questions, generally speaking. All right, thank you, Linda.
Thank you
and
so much.
I look
all
forward
right,
to
bye.
Talking to you again soon on this.
All right, great.
Okay, Brent here? Yeah, he's unmuted. Brent, do you want to take some time here? I know it's kind of late, but we're here. I don't hear you. I see your mic has been unmuted, but I don't hear you. Terry, Jen, did you unmute Brent, or did he unmute himself?
He unmuted himself, from what I know.
Maybe there's another mute button he's got on his mic or something.
He knows pretty much how to work it.
Yeah. Brent, if you're there. All right, meanwhile, if anybody has any questions or comments, get yourself into the queue, *6 to get into the queue. And Brent, as soon as you get your mic going and you want to pick it up, just cut in and let me know. You've been unmuted, muted, unmuted. You're unmuted on this end. Maybe maybe you got your mic all the way down low, or maybe there's a button on your mic, or maybe it's not plugged in. I don't know, something. Or maybe you have a mute on your computer.
Well, we do have some email questions.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that. While we're waiting for Brent to try to get his mic on, let's take the email questions.
Okay, first question. I filed for unemployment and was denied, and then appealed the decision. It then went to circuit court, then to appeals court, and was denied. Then transferred to the Supreme Court in my state. Then there was a mandate sent stating the deposition appeal transfer to Supreme Court denied. What are the options after this ruling?
Well, it doesn't sound too good. Dealing with the Department of Labor is it's another government agency. Believe me, I've been hung up in that for quite some time and many years back, and they're as evil as any other. I don't have any further advice for that. You went through all the whole process. The only other thing you can do is wait till we get to the other side. The other side meaning that we get back to just courts, which is possible if the people step up. The opportunity will be available, I think, once the military does what they need to do. So the opportunity will be there. And if the people in your county step up and you get a committee of safety going, then you can get a just court going and we can take it back there. But, you seem to have exhausted the whole process. So I don't have anything else to say on that. So.
Okay.
You're a casualty of war. But go ahead, Jan. Next question.
Yeah, next question is, I realize that one can be banned from filing lawsuits if there have been many filed which have been found to be frivolous. But what if none of my cases has ever been declared as frivolous, but I have filed many that have been denied? Is there a way to find out?
First of all, I don't know that they can deny you access because they claim you brought too many frivolous cases. They're frivolous. Probably doesn't apply that way. But in any event, look, if you're going into court, you should always be looking for a jury. And they're always trying to deny you the jury, unfortunately. But read that question again. I know there was something else I wanted to say.
Okay, next question. I would like to know what, if anything, Wisconsin has established.
Hold on. Could you reread that other question? Because there was something else I wanted to say, I think. There was a question before. Reread that.
I realize that one can be banned from filing lawsuits.
Okay. Yeah, you cannot be banned from filing lawsuits. I mean, where is that power and authority? I doubt they even have a statute that says that, they kind of do things off the cuff. Like we read in the paper tonight, ignorance of the law is no excuse, that kind of thing. Same thing here. I mean, where is the legislation, and how does legislation apply to us? You know, that'd be the question I would have to the court. They're always telling me my cases are frivolous. They're always saying that. And my cases are no way frivolous. My cases are full of facts and full of proof, of documents, everything. I mean, I wouldn't even bother going into the court if I don't feel confident that I could win on the contents of what I bring in. So, but you know, they really can't do that. I would take it. I'd take it into the federal court if you're in a state court to fight it, refusing you due process. All right, next question.
Okay, I would like to know what, if anything, Wisconsin has established. Do any of our 72 counties have their assemblies started? What can I do to make this happen? Who do I take the paperwork to for the real official verification to get our ball rolling?
Well, first of all, you go to People's Duty. That is the key. Then you get the handbooks, go to handbooks, okay, and you start the process there. Now, if you want to find out if it's already been started, which I would suggest to people should do, is you highlight People's Duty, and you go to, Committee of Safety, highlight that, and you come down to find your county Committee of Safety. Now, what state was he in? He or she?
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin. So we'll go to Wisconsin. We'll click on Wisconsin. Does he give us the county? He doesn't give us the county, does he? Okay, in this particular case, well, let me make sure we're on the right paper here because, I know, let me go back a step here to make sure we got the links proper here. Let me go to New York because I know we have some going in New York. Okay, in New York, yep, well, we got Committee of Safety Leaders. Okay, right there in New York. So in New York, we have three counties that have started Committees of Safety, Broome, Dutchess, and Wayne. And there's the phone number of the person, the name and the person, and the phone number of the person who started it. So if you're in those counties and you want to get involved, you click on that and get some information from the person going on. Now, going back to your state, which is Wisconsin, okay. In Wisconsin, nobody has started a Committee of Safety. So you should come up here and sign up to become a Committee of Safety, to get a Committee of Safety going. Now, there should be a button here. I don't know why I'm not
seeing
it.
Be careful.
Let's see it. Hi, Brent, I see that you're unmuted now.
Yeah, can you? If you can hear me, yes,
we
I'm being
can
heard.
Hear you. You found a way to fix it. Give me a minute,
okay.
And we'll pass it to you for whatever time we have left. Okay.
All right.
Hold I'm my, sorry it's so fine. Late. We got lost. You know, and good stuff though. I thought. I thought it was a good.
Well, I had a chance to get on, but I unmuted myself, but the technology just wouldn't allow it. So that's just the way it is. As they say, it is what it is. But. Yeah, go ahead, and then when you're ready, let me know.
Right. Okay, so we're not seeing anything here, so I think there may be another place for a button to start it. Let me just go back over and see it, but it should have been on that page. So we'll go into Committees of Safety. Okay, we're going to find it. There's no one there, so you're not finding it. So Committee of Safety, Instructional, Organizing your Committee of Safety. Okay. I don't know why there isn't a button here to start a Committee of Safety. Let me go to New York because we got, I know I went up here and filed and two other people filed. Okay.
Yeah.
You should be able to once you file in here, you should be able to download all your members by getting the from county to county, the first name and phone numbers. And, you know, be able to make contact with those people to see if you can get them to join up with you. But I don't know why I don't see it here.
Yeah, I can't find the list of started Committee of Safeties anymore either.
We got to look into this and try to figure out what's going on with this because I don't see a way for people to put their name up here to make that process go. But we'll leave that alone for now. We'll hopefully discuss it next week. Okay, but anyway, there is nothing in your state, Wisconsin, so... Just get started. It starts with one person meeting with another person. You can do very informal meetings in the beginning, and meet at a coffee shop off the fly just to discuss ideas and thoughts and start getting ready to organize. And then when you're ready to invite people, then you, when you have a couple people together, maybe three, four or more people, and then you invite a whole bunch of people, you get a meeting going and you start the process. And all you have to do is go to the people's duty, okay, come down to handbooks, click on handbooks, and you come down to Committee of Safety Handbook, and this will step you through step by step from the beginning to the end, all the way through. We have videos, and we have certain subjects and videos and different things that you play on the first meeting and meeting two and meeting three. You know, we give very clear instructions, and at some point, maybe meeting four or something or whatever, you'll have a list of all kinds of different subjects you can bring up, and it's different videos that you can run and then discuss for the upcoming meetings after. And it doesn't have to be in any certain order, but with order that you feel seems logical to the next meeting, that's all. But the first three or so meetings should be followed through exactly what we're doing, because it's a process to create the whole structure of the Committee of Safety and you get your resolutions. Let me take a step back here again. Hold on. Where was I on that? Handbooks. Okay, here, yeah. You got your charter, okay, and your resolution. Within the first 3 months, you should be able, or the first three meetings, should be able to accomplish that. A charter and a resolution, and therefore you have a structure, and then you're ready to approach the sheriff, and then you're following through with all kinds of subject matters and things you need to learn and get involved with and so on. Okay, is there another question?
There is a second part to that that says, is there another way to contact the Wisconsin rep? I've received no feedback from him. How is this group affiliated with Jay Gould or Anna Von Ritz? I'm curious.
Well, I don't know who Jay Gould is, but Anna Von Ritz, definitely not. Anna Von Ritz, in the heart of what she's doing, is to discard the Constitution and follow up and create a new constitution. So, I don't know. But in any event, we're not associated with either of them. But making contact, there's no one to make contact with as far as it started a Committee of Safety in your state, in your county. So you have to be the one to do it. And well, if you can't get the list down of people in your county, Jan will help you. If you contact Jan at nationalliberty.org and ask him, he'll download it for you. We have to get these buttons up there, Jan. We have to talk with Carl and get these buttons up for the people who do it themselves. So, okay, any other questions?
Here's a quick one. Are we able to stop these radical agendas by seeking injunctions? Mask and vaccine mandates, gun control, flooding the country with non-Americans, causing division and gerrymandering.
Well, all those problems need to be dealt with, but we're not going to be able to deal with them now. We're going to have to deal with them on the other side. The mask, I just ignore them. I don't even bother with them. The only place I ever get hit up for a mask anymore these days is you go to a federal building, they want you to wear one, and I refuse to wear them. And, or you go into a medical facility, they try to make you wear them. And I usually make a big argument with them. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't to get access to. But the federal building, the only federal building I go into is the post office, and they can go to Hades. So, all right, we're going to forego any other questions so we can move to Brent. We haven't really much time, so let's give him whatever time we have left. Brent, you want the mic?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you, John. This
Thank
is Brent.
You got it. Take Brent as much time Allen. As you want. Not that there's much, but if you want to go a little over, that's fine. Don't worry about it. Okay, Brent Allen Winters.
Thanks, John.
Okay, this is Brent Allen Winters. He's a common law lawyer, and his website is commonlawyer.com. He's the author of The Excellence of the Common Law and various other books and handbooks. Brent, you got the mic.
Thank you, John. This is Brent, and you can find me at commonlawyer.com, and you can listen to me on the radio. It tells you there how to do that. You can click on the links. Most of the radio is on the on the internet these days. But just to draw a quick distinction between them and us, the Democrats, the Communists, the Socialists, the Pinkos, all the folk on the what the French call the left, that's who started that whole idea of the left and the right, was the French during the French Revolution. The left and the right, and of course, in the Bible, Jesus Christ separates the goats and the sheep to the left and the right. And the left and the right has become indicative of the two possible extremes of positions that a fellow can take. Well, the left, they're passionate about freedom. Ask them, they'll tell you. And the right, they're passionate about freedom too. And if you aren't really passionate about freedom, you hate your neighbor. You don't love your neighbor. You hate him. Because if you're not passionate about it for yourself, how could you possibly care about him? So to be passionate for freedom is important, but both the left and the right say they're passionate, but here's the difference. Here's the difference. The freedom that the left, the Democrats / communist pinkos, that crowd, all the freedoms that they want for everybody, you could exercise every one of them in a jail cell. All the freedoms they want for you, you could exercise in a jail cell. Pansy Nalosi wants everybody to have a paycheck, no matter what, a basic subsistence income from the federal government. Well, you could give that to people in jail. Of course, they want health care for everybody without anybody having to pay. You can get that in jail, too. They want everybody to have a meal to eat three times.
Well, you roboted and then disappeared, Brent.
Freedom. Really, freedom, true freedom.
Thank you.
Yeah, they can't give it to you. They can't give it to you in a jail. Because fundamentally, there I went. Somebody said, "You're gone, Brent." Can anybody talk to me out there?
Yeah, I got you back now. You went away. You were just about to talk more about the jail, and then you went away. But you're back now.
No. Oh, okay. Well, thank you. No, the freedom that is fundamental, as Blackstone says, is freedom of bodily locomotion to go where you want. In the jail, you can't do that except when they unlock the doors, and they unlock them every 15 minutes and every 30 minutes and every hour on the hour, and you can go to the next room, but not before. That's not freedom. No freedom of bodily locomotion. Well, of course, if you have freedom, you can't start a business in prison, but the left doesn't care about you starting a business or trying to turn a buck. Matter of fact, it's against the law in prison to turn a buck. It's against the law in prison to possess government-minted money. So that's not going to happen there. Well, that was one point, that one distinction that ought to be made. All the freedoms the left wants, you can exercise in a jail cell. Now, another point I want to make, thinking about an experience I've had several times, and that is this, that the solution to a problem is not the problem. Those are two different things. The solution to a problem is not the problem. How oft has it happened to me in the last year and a half or whatever, however long it's been since this childish stupidity of putting a diaper on your head started, How often has it been that I'm walking someplace or I'm in a place of business like a gas station and I'm minding my own business? I'm not bothered anybody else. And somebody says to me, "You got to wear a mask." And I say, "Thank you very much for the medical advice. I'll give you my address and you can send me a bill." Trying to lighten things up a little bit. Well, things don't always lighten up. They get worse. "No, you got to have a mask on to be in here." Well, I'm the solution. I'm the solution to their problem. But then they say I'm the problem, and I've started trouble. I didn't start any trouble. I didn't even talk to anybody. But all of a sudden, I'm the problem. No, I'm the solution. And to not wear a mask is a statement for freedom against damnable lies. Well, just keep that in mind, I suppose. The solution is not the problem. The solution is not the problem. And then the other thing is that all the freedoms that the left wants you to have, you could exercise in a jail cell. And all the freedoms that God wants you to exercise, you got to get out of the jail to exercise them. This is Brent, Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com, www.commonlawyer.com. You can go to the website and join us. Excuse me, I'm getting tired. Join us on Thursday mornings at 8 o'clock for the class, law school class, Sheriff, the Sheriff at Common Law. The American Sheriff at Common Law, Sheriff Darleaf. John mentioned Sheriff Dar a while ago. About 20 years he's been sheriff up in Berry County, Michigan. He's agreed to teach the course with me, and we're having a lot of fun. I'm learning a lot, talking about the history of the sheriff. What it really comes down to is the posse, and that's what we're talking a whole lot about, is the sheriff's posse and what that means. Well, join us. You can go to the website, commonlawyer.com, and you can join us there. There it'll tell you how to sign up and take advantage of the other things that are there, books that are written, and oral presentations that are made. Well, back to you, John, if you're there.
Okay, thank you, Brent. Appreciate it. Okay, it's a couple of minutes to midnight, and I'll tell you, we've got California Fred there. We'll take you for a couple of minutes. We've got 4 minutes. I'd like to get to bed on time tonight. So, California Fred, you got the mic. Go right ahead.
Hey, John. Did you hear me?
I can hear you.
Well, yes, sir. I more wanted to make a comment than ask a question, sir.
Sure.
I ordered 2 of your books.
Okay.
Wait a long time, and they finally came.
Ah. Yeah, well, we were back-ordered quite a bit, but and there's still people looking for books. When did they come?
About 2 weeks after I ordered. Now, here's the comment I wanted to make, sir.
Okay.
I've been reading your book cover to cover. And then all of a sudden, you pulled up and gave me 2 more books.
Oh, boy.
And I checked my billing. I was only billed for 2 books and paid postage for 2 books.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of people who haven't received books, and I'm trying to get information to discover exactly where to send them and to find out if they actually ordered it from me or they ordered it from, directly from Dorrance. But let me do this. I see you coming in. Let's see. I see you got your email here. If I send you some information, okay, to 2 sheriffs that you can mail them to, would you mail them? And if you do it, by book rate, anybody could do book rate. You tell them it's book rate. They charge you $4.30, I think it is, each book to mail out, and it could take a week to 10 days to get it to them, but it'll get it to them. Would you be willing to do that?
Yes, sir. 2 of the books. I ordered 2 for a reason. 1 for myself, and 1 for a lady that's fighting CPS.
Okay.
So you send me the info, and I'll send two books out to the...
Yeah, what I'll do is I'm going to send you... You know what I'll do is I'm going to send you an email for your mailing address, and I'm going to send you two stickers, okay? And the two stickers, one for each book, and they go in... Hang on a minute, my... Okay.
Do you do me a favor also, sir?
I'm sorry?
You also do me a favor, sir?
Sure.
You mentioned the fact that don't mail books to the sheriff because you want them to come from you because you
right.
have specific information.
Right. Well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to mail you two boxes, okay? And I'm going to mail you two stickers, and this will all show that it's coming from National Liberty Alliance, and in the paperwork we'll have two letters, one from the National Liberty Alliance and one from Sheriff Darr. And these letters, you put in, you know, fold them and stick them in the book. There's a sticker that makes the book the property of the sheriff's office, okay? And you put that in the front cover of the book.
I have the plastic to do that, sir.
I'm sorry?
I have to tear the plastic off to do that. I'd rather mail them sealed.
Well, yeah, you have to tear the plastics off to do that. That's correct. But once I'm going to send you two boxes, though. And you put, and I'll put the address for the sheriff and everything in those boxes. So all you have to do is just take the plastic off the books. You take one letter. There'll be two letters for one from us and one from Sheriff Darr. You fold them up, stick them in the inside of the book with the sticker on the inside cover. Put it into the box, which will already be pre. It'll have a mailing address and everything. And then just stick them in the mail. And do if you do a book rate, just tell them it's a book rate, and they should only charge you
$4. So I'll send it. Don't worry about it.
Okay. So I'll send that to you. I'll send you an email, and if you respond to the email with your mailing address, I will then stick it into the mail in the next day or two, and you'll get it.
All right, sir.
I appreciate
it. I'll respond to the email tomorrow.
Huh?
The computer I will respond to you is outside, and it's
okay
to go out there. I'm doing it here in my bedroom on the second.
Uh-huh. All right. Well, whenever you get to it, just send me an email, and I'll send you with your address, your mailing address, and then I'll acknowledge when I get it by email, and I'll drop into the mail that that stuff in order to put it into the box and send it out. Okay.
To verify everything, I ordered from that bookstore, not from NLA.
Okay. I don't understand. You got two orders from the bookstore?
Yes, sir.
Hmm. That's strange. Well, we'll use them anyway. We'll send them to sheriffs.
We'll do it.
Okay. All right. I appreciate it. So everything will be very easy. You just put the sticker in the front cover of the book. You take the folded letters. You stick them in the front cover. You stick it in a box, you close the lid on the box and just put some tape to close the lid, you know, to seal the lid, and it'll be pre-addressed and ready to go.
All right. Consider it done as soon as I get the stuff, sir.
Okay. I thank you very much. Now, do you have another question or a point or anything?
I owe another $116 and another $90 for shipping.
I'm sorry. Say that again.
I owe another $116 and $90 for shipping?
No, we'll just send them out to the sheriff. Don't worry about it, no.
Don't worry about that money?
I'm sorry, say it again?
It cost me $116 for two books and $90 to get them.
Right.
And sent me a double order. Do I owe money to the bookstore?
Oh, no. No, we'll just send them out to people. You know, if that's an error on their side, that's fine. We'll send it out. You know, I've been trying to get them to work with us to give us a better deal so we can get more books out to sheriffs, and they've been pretty hardcore against that. They did help a little bit, but it was a buck or two. It was no big deal, where they could really do a lot better. And I'm thinking, you know, should I even talk about this? This place had a lot of problems. I'm thinking of suing them. I don't really have the time to sue them, so I may not for that reason only. But, you know, in any event,
I love your book. I can't put it down. It's a page turner.
Oh, I appreciate that. Well, I'll tell you what, I loved writing it. You know, it took a long time to write it, many, many years. And when I was writing papers. I didn't write it as a book, but it was very easy to put together as a book. And I really enjoyed the research. The information that I discovered is just so valuable and so interesting. And like you say, you can't take your eyes off of it. You know, it's because it's powerful.
Reading, it's a labor of love. Well,
oh,
we're
absolutely. Yeah. All right, is that it?
Yes. So you wanted to keep this quick.
Okay. Yeah. Time to go to bed. All right. Well, for you, it's a little earlier. What? It's 9 o'clock your way, huh?
Yes.
Yeah, it's midnight for me. So. Okay. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, Fred.
Thank you, Mr. Brush.
Okay. All right. With that, Lord willing, we'll see you all next Monday, and we'll pick it up where we left off. I'm not sure what the subject matter will be, but I'll figure that out, and we'll do something. Okay. And I'll throw it into an email. Good night, everybody.